You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.
Hey, this is regular vanilla. I wanted Vanilla Twist.
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
This man's got nerves!
Make love in the hammock!
What?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 133 for the 28th of May, 2011. I am Dave McVeigh, and it's a full studio. I am joined by Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
I've been moving all week, so don't ask me that question. I ban you for asking me how I'm feeling. Next.
And we're also joined for the first time by Mr. Richard Gray from The Real Bits and DVDBits.coms, respectively. How are you, Richard?
I have got the cold, but it gives me a seductive deep voice, so I'm good with that.
Oh, the deep voice is always
has a radio voice right now, doesn't he?
It's a big radio voice this morning.
All right, so this is the Film Actually podcast, the official movie podcast of GeekActually.com. And what are we doing this week? We are going to review The Hangover Part 2. Now, unfortunately, because Josh has been moving all week, he hasn't had a chance to see it yet. But Richard and I are going to carry that one. But Josh and I are going to review the new low-budget Australian film, The Tunnel.
Hooray.
So we're going to have two film reviews this week. Plus, of course, we've got a little bit of film news that we're going to cover, a couple new trailers, and, of course, we have a brand new list of five. Five great low-budget films is what we're doing because of The Tunnel. So we're going to do that. But first, let's do some feedback. All right, so feedback this week, and we have one from Geek Betty. Actually, we have two from Geek Betty, and the first one from Geek Betty I have to share with you. It's from harpers.org. She sent the link and basically said she thought I might find this amusing, and I did, let me tell you. It's actually an email exchange from 2001 between Judd Apatow, the creator of sitcoms Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared and all those movies that he's worked on, and Mark Brazil, the creator of That 70s Show. Mm. Apparently, Topher Grace was considered for one of Judd Apatow's projects, and Mark Brazil took a lot of offense to the fact that Judd Apatow was trying to poach his actor, but it's because they have I don't even know how you'd word this, altercation would be a word, I guess, which apparently Judd Apatow had no knowledge of. But Mark Brazil was really angry at him, and Harper's has published this exchange of emails. Now, we're not going to go through the whole thing because it's way too long, but the bottom line is, we'll just give you a taste of what it is. The first one is from Judd Apatow, where he says, "Mark, I am writing you because I left a message but did not hear back. I understand that you were upset about me not calling you to ask if Topher could do our show. Since Fox executives were talking to Topher about it, I thought it was cool with you. Also, since I hadn't written it yet, it wasn't at the point of asking if it was possible to have him do it. I would have called your show then. I didn't realize it would create a problem. I never wished to offend you. If there is some protocol for people on Fox doing guest shots on other Fox shows, I didn't know what it was, regardless." And it goes on, right? So it's, and he signs off the first email by saying, "I only remember us having fun in the early 90s, and it troubles me that it seems like you have a beef with me." Mark basically goes on to say, "Yeah, we were friends in the early 90s, and if you don't recall what happened, I'll remind you. I had a pilot at MTV called Yard Dogs about a rock band living in Hollywood. I told you about it, and you proceeded to completely rip it off. Storyline and all, for the Ben Stiller show, you called it Grungies," and it goes on. Where it really starts getting fun is as you get down to about the middle of it, Mark actually signs off one of his emails by saying, He goes, have you read my play, What Makes Sammy Run? I think you'd like it. Get cancer. And it moves on from there. And it's this amazing exchange that just, and it's, as Geek Betty pointed out, it's very, very eloquent writers having goes at each other. And it's hysterical by the time, because they really rip into each other by the time it gets to the end, and well worth a read. So the link is in our show notes. Please go and read this, because it is quality stuff. She also sent a link. She's been very busy this week, Geek Betty. She also sent a link for a new film coming out, a new documentary, which I had not heard of. Had you heard of this, Richard?
I think I have, actually. I seem to remember it causing a bit of...
I'm trying to figure out whether it's a mockumentary or if this is for real.
It looks for real.
It does look for real. I've got the trailer here. Now, for our audio listeners, this is going to be... it's kind of hard because some of it is subtitled, so you're not going to get the full gist of it. But the movie is called Donkey Love. Now,
wow.
I think I'll let your mind reel on that for a minute.
No, it's gone. It's come back. Keep moving.
What's gone? What?
My
what?
Mind.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's probably pretty close to the truth.
So let me run this trailer, and I'll leave the mics open so people can make their comments if they want to. But this is the trailer for a film, a new documentary called Donkey Love.
It's nice to be in a country where the women are beautiful and the men have sex with donkeys.
Because there's no tourism here, nobody else in the rest of the world knows about Colombia's favorite pastime.
You guys gotta let Colombia's biggest secret out the bag.
He's gonna do what? Oh, look what we have here.
Burras.
Burras. Donkeys.
Call them over here. Wow. Wow. Just up the game.
Just up the game.
Es real. Contigo, presencial.
So for our audio listeners, what they're saying is basically, yes, men in Colombia like to have sex with donkeys. And who knew? Who knew this was a thing?
And it was Colombia's biggest secret, apparently.
Apparently, yeah. No, it sounds pretty heavy.
License for dressed up as David Bowie from the movie Labyrinth.
Hey, I got a question for you.
So my question is... we need details on this. Does anybody know who this documentary maker is, to start with? Is he somebody famous we should know about?
I don't know. He seems really charismatic.
He does. I think he comes across as feeling like he might be a comedian.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, and this is what makes me wonder whether or not, is this for real or not? Or is this just something he's put together? Because if it's just something he's been put together, it's kind of funny. But
I
if it's
want
for
it
real,
to be real,
I want it to be real. So
I think it's going to be funnier if it is real, because you're just going to be like, "Well, there you go. I was not aware of that."
So, yeah. So we'll keep our eyes open and see if Donkey Love ever comes out, and then maybe we'll watch it. I don't know. Will it get past Australian censors if it comes out?
I don't think the OFLC will like that.
Although they pass Sex and Zen Extreme Ecstasy.
So, you know, so if Donkey Love comes out in 3D, it'll be fine.
And it's subtitled.
And it's subtitled.
It's subtitled.
It's subtitled. That will win it over.
That's right. Absolutely. In Australia, that will get it passed. All right. Now, our friend Matt... who was in our chat room before, is he still here with us?
Nikos.
No. This is Zeng Fu.
Oh, right, yes. No, he's taken off.
He's taken off. All right. Matt wrote to us and said, this may be something that you've already covered in a previous show, but a recent conversation with a friend got me thinking about what would be a top five political films. Given that I have recently been catching up on Film Action and now have dozens of movies to go out and watch based upon the lists of five, I am wondering if you have any recommendations in this area. This is a great idea for a list, and we will cover that. We're not doing it today because it didn't quite fit within the theme of the show, but we will do a top five political films, because we all have favorites in that arena. What's the next politically charged major film coming out? Do we know?
Well, I follow them, obviously, very heavily, so no. I have
Captain America, I think.
There you go. I think that could actually... Apparently, I was reading the other day that it may actually have a title change in other countries around the world. One of the reasons why they added the first Avenger.
Captain Freedom.
So that they would actually, on other countries, just release it as the first Avenger.
Oh, really?
They just dropped the Captain America part off.
Yeah, no, that works.
So that kind of makes sense now as to why they added that subtitle to it. Okay, so that's our feedback. Let's get into our first feature film review. First of all, we'll do The Hangover Part 2. Now, we've actually spoken on this show before about saying how it's really hard to review comedy. And we don't generally do a lot of comedies as reviews because it's really subjective. The most subjective thing in the world is humor. But it is a big film, and so I thought we should have a look at it. And we did do the first part. So let's do this one. We'll say Hangover Part 2, directed by Todd Phillips and written by Craig Mazin. Scott Armstrong and Todd Phillips. It stars Bradley Cooper, Ed Helms, Zach Galifianakis, Justin Bartha, Ken Jeong, Mason Lee, Jamie Chung, Sasha Barisi, I want to say, Jeffrey Tambor, and Paul Giamatti. Now, I had a question before we go any further. You know this cameo that was supposed to be Mel Gibson, and then he was fired, and then they brought in Liam Neeson, and then he basically bowed out. Is that the Giamatti character?
It must be.
Or was it the tattooist? That was the one I was thinking of.
Yes. It could be the tattooist because...
You need to get a bit closer to your mic.
Oh, sorry. The old... The person I thought was going to do a cameo and it didn't turn up.
Who was what?
I thought that was Bill Clinton, but did he leave at some stage?
Oh, that's right. I'd heard something about that,
too. Bill Clinton was going to do a cameo at some stage.
I think they were just throwing these names around just to get people like us excited. It's like, yeah, now we got Bill Clinton now.
I have this funny suspicion that it was the Paul Giamatti character, but I'd like to think it was the tattooist. Yeah, that would have been a much better cameo.
Yeah.
To have had somebody throwing in this little tattooist role.
Oh, there is a song and dance number, I'd say anyone could have filled that one in.
Yeah. All right, so we've grabbed the synopsis from IMDb. This time it comes from a user on IMDb because the actual basic IMDb one was really boring. So Joey Grass 25 on IMDb, we're stealing your synopsis. And he says, in the follow-up to the record-breaking hit The Hangover, Phil, Stu, Alan, and Doug travel to exotic Thailand for Stu's wedding. After the unforgettable bachelor party in Las Vegas, Stu is taking no chances and has opted for a safe, subdued pre-wedding brunch. However, things don't always go as planned. What happens in Vegas may stay in Vegas, but what happens in Bangkok can't even be imagined.
That's kind of cool. I like that.
All right, so that's a well-written Joey Grass 25. We have a trailer. We'll have a quick look at this trailer, and then we will talk about this and see whether we liked it or not.
Can we get much higher? Hey everybody, here are some fun facts. The population in Thailand is 63 million people. It is twice the size of Wyoming. None of you know Stu like I do. I can't even tell you what we've been through because we made a pact. What I can tell you is this. This is not Stu's first marriage. There was a whore in Las Vegas a couple of years
ago. Time's up, sit down, bud.
Come have a drink with me and the guys.
Go and do me a favor. Take my little brother Teddy with you.
That is a great idea. Bring the kid.
All right, one drink.
You did it, buddy.
Sure did.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
What the hell? I wanna see
you at the mountain. Oh,
your hair is gone.
No.
Oh.
I'm scared.
Stu, come on, get up. We gotta situate.
Holy.
Where are we?
You're gonna freak out, but it's gonna be okay.
What's, is it my teeth?
This is a real tattoo!
Alan, what did you do? Did you roofie me?
I didn't do anything.
No! Ah!
Oh, jeez. Ah! It's a monkey!
Where are you guys?
I don't know. We woke up in some city.
Is Teddy with you?
They've been looking for him all morning.
I can't believe this is happening again.
It's Laura's little brother. He's lost. We're not going back without Teddy.
We love to party.
All I wanted was a bachelor brunch.
Ciao!
What are you doing here?
Buddy's my plus one.
We had a sick night, bitches.
Whoa.
Check your pockets.
There might be clues.
Chiang Mai Monastery.
I don't remember any of this.
What is this, a P.F. Chang's?
Where the hell are you?
We're in Bangkok.
Hala, hideous squala.
Pull that monkey in!
He's so strong!
Hold on!
Yeah, boy!
Hey guys, check it out. Alan,
cut it out.
When a monkey nibbles on a weenus, it's funny in any language.
Never okay. Truer words have been spoken.
Absolutely. All right, Richard, we'll start with you. What did you think of The Hangover Part 2?
Well, look, I think one of the main things is they realised really early on that they were never going to be able to replicate the simple joys of the first one. And what struck, I think, most people with the first film, thank you, just having my mic adjusted on me there. What I think struck most people with the first film was just how surprisingly funny it was. You know, it took us all by surprise. It really was one of those sleeper hits that just took off.
And it was completely raw.
And it was completely raw, yeah. And it was surprising. So there was no way in hell they're actually going to be able to replicate that rawness and that surprise element from the first film. So they didn't try.
No.
Why bother?
And as you can see by the trailer, they don't try. I mean, they reenact the first film almost beat for beat.
And that's surprising, just how close it is to the first film, how much they reenact it. And you know what? I'm okay with that.
Yep.
Because it's still fun at the end of the day.
Well, and they also make a joke of the fact that it is the same event. All the way through it, they keep talking about how similar
this
is.
Audience.
Yeah, it's a big wink to the audience, basically saying, I can't believe this is happening again. Look at this. You know, it's all happening again. I will say that Zach Galifianakis was extraordinarily unlikable as a character in the first film, and they actually managed to make him even more unlikable. It is really it's almost like he took a page out of Due Date.
Exactly. I think in the first movie that he was sort of this sort of affable idiot, you know, you kind of liked him despite yourself.
In this one, though, he seemed bitter.
He did seem bitter, and they start with that. And you're right, I think Due Date's a really good comparison, because Due Date, I think, in a lot of ways showed us how good Hangover was.
No truer words have been said. It's no secret on this show. I hated Due Date. I thought it was a film of completely unlikable characters.
Yeah, it was no one
across the board. And I really hated Zach Galifianakis in particular over everyone else.
And it's really hard to dislike Robert Downey Jr.
It is really hard. and I didn't like him at all. And I thought, wow, this is it's an extraordinary job to do that. Mm. So I actually went into Hangover 2 with trepidation, because I thought, was Hangover 1 a pure fluke in this situation? And it wasn't. I mean, he does have the right formula going again with The Hangover. And The Hangover is a fairly solid comedy. It does make you laugh out loud.
There's some genuine laughs.
Genuinely funny moments. It does make you snicker at some of the stuff where you go, because it's familiar. And you go, oh, there it is again. Ed Helm, once again, steals the film. I mean, Ed Helm is he's the guy, for those who don't know, who ripped his tooth out in the first one and has the tattoo this time around. He's our foil. He's who we're relating to this entire circumstance through, and he is great. There's no problem with him at all. Mr. Chow, once again, delivers some very funny stuff, but he's in it too much.
Yes.
He's funny in very small doses.
Absolutely. And I think that was maybe one of the mistakes they made. It was kind of like, oh, people like that stuff. Let's include it a lot. It was kind of like I hate to compare it to the Star Wars prequel trilogy, but it was kind of like, you know what? People like lightsaber fights. Let's throw in 16 of them per film.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they've sort of done the same thing here. These are all the things that were cool in the first film. Let's just have wall-to-wall references to them.
It's a producer's wet dream. That's the problem with the film. It's just like, what worked? What can we definitely get people in with?
And
grab the moments that they can. It's like, it's so interesting because Zach is one of those people who I just think is either going to burn out or reinvent himself, because he's running out of steam. Like,
there are a lot of people. The character has worn thin.
Yeah. And he is still playing the same guy. And it's like, it's the problem with being a comedian is you pick one side or the other. You either wear it out until no one cares about you anymore and continue trying to drive that drive, or you reinvent yourself. And he's got, I reckon, borderline 6 months to do something with himself.
Yeah.
He was going to be in something recently where he would have had to play a serious role, but he backed out of it recently. So he's...
That might actually be a very mature thing for him to have done, because he may not have had it in him.
Yeah, you know?
True.
Well, I can't remember. I'm drawing a blank. I've been doing that all week. But
you've been moving house, though.
Yeah. but yeah, no, whatever role it was, whoever they picked instead, I was kind of like, yeah, that sounds like a much better choice. But it would have been interesting. It's like with any character that plays something outside themselves, I'll always give them a wide berth and be like, do what you can, and I'll take you as whatever you do in this role. But yeah, no, he's got to do something, man, because this is just the same character.
Now, there's mixed feelings on the star. We say the star, it's an ensemble piece, but there is a star, and that's Bradley Cooper. Absolutely. I mean, Bradley Cooper is the headliner here. And there's mixed feelings on Bradley Cooper. I know that one of the past hosts of this show, Dave Kosicki, hates Bradley Cooper, thinks he's a complete douche. I actually don't mind Bradley Cooper in the right role. I think he can play a complete douche really, really easily, and that's it probably comes a little too easy to him. Such
he's
as
McConaughey
face
without the internal laugh at himself.
Without the charm as well, though. He doesn't. Yeah. McConaughey's got a charm to him that you just
likeable. Bradley Cooper is being marketed as the man with the charm.
But that's the problem. He's being marketed that way. Does he really have it? That's the bigger issue.
Again, if someone's got washboard abs nowadays, it doesn't really matter how deep you try and make that character.
So, Richard, what are your opinions on Bradley Cooper?
He's dreamy.
He's dreamy.
See, told you right there. Perfect example.
I like him. He's great. I mean,
I don't know. You've seen Limitless.
Limitless,
right?
Was Look, you know, it was. I think he carried Limitless. Limitless would have worked in the hands of anyone slightly less charming. You know, he is the cool guy at the center of this. He's the guy that Zach's character wants to be.
The one that he idolizes.
And you know, you need that. I mean, it worked really well in the context of the first film because it was Las Vegas. You needed that slick kind of guy coming in, and you know, he seems a little bit more of a fish out of water this time around.
That's actually one of the things I was thinking. Is it actually works kind of? It works kind of that he isn't the cool guy anymore. He is so alien to this area.
Yeah.
And this film, I actually really liked him. I've said this before. I really liked him in Wedding Crashers when he played the psychotic boyfriend. And he had those. It's the first time I'd ever actually seen him in a film. And I remember those psychotic eyes, and I just thought, there's something very wrong with you, you know?
From the minute he arrives on screen,
and he is magnetic in that
role. He's going to take it up a notch. I'm looking at Internet Movie Database this morning, and apparently he's playing Lucifer in Paradise Lost.
I can see that.
If you think he's evil, he's playing up on it.
Wow. Well, you know what?
I was actually going to say that one of my favorite roles of his was actually early on in his career. He was in a fucking terrible film, but he was one of the people in... he was the lead in Midnight Meat Train.
Midnight Meat Train,
and
yes.
He is fucking creepy in that. So it's like, I prefer him when he's playing creepy.
I think this could be a really good move for him because he is suave, he is handsome, you know, he's dreamy and all that sort of stuff. But I think to grow as an actor, he needs to not be doing that. I think he needs to be doing something.
He needs to do the Brad Pitt 12 Monkeys thing. He needs to do that thing that just all the girls that like him look at him and go, ew. And then
he
like,
needs to
the
have
rest
a what the fuck moment, quite frankly.
Exactly.
Yeah, he needs to have that moment where everybody goes, shit, I didn't see that coming, you know? And then after that, he can basically do whatever he wants. You know, he needs to break the barrier. But he needs to do that and be successful.
Now, as the only one that hasn't seen it, and I'm going to pose this to Richard, is there enough power in it for a third one? Like, or do you think they've killed it?
I think the third one's inevitable at this point. But, you know, assuming there's a box office for it. But, look, I personally think that this should be it. I don't think there was enough power to sustain this one. It did start flailing. Well, the funny thing is, for a film that actually consciously acknowledges that it's going to completely ape the first film, it takes a long time to get going. It takes a long time to set up the fact that we're going to be just doing it all over again. So I think momentum's in the back half of it. If that just gone straight to Bangkok.
Which is so weird because I feel that in the first one, it peters off towards the end.
Exactly.
So it's like they've kind of tried to counterbalance that and actually screwed it up.
Well, the last 20, 30 minutes of it are just frenetic and they're actually really good. And you will be, if you're not, you know, splitting your sides outright, you'll be chuckling a bit for most of the ending of it. So if the next film's got that sort of momentum in it, and I don't know where they could possibly go.
I'm actually on the side of the fence that basically says if they do make a third one of these, it's doomed for failure.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
There's only so many times. It's the same problem that Die Hard 3 had, where you sit, and I really enjoyed Die Hard 3, but there's a situation where you kind of go, you need to really do something very different with this.
Yeah.
Mm. Because otherwise it's just the same thing again and again and again. And to their credit in Die Hard 3, they actually did do something different. Because if they had just done, because Die Hard 1 and 2 were so similar in their concept that if they hadn't broken it out, if they hadn't done something else with it, then you would have had nothing to go with.
Well, Die Hard 3 was another script. It was something else entirely.
That's right.
And they just decided to make it a Die Hard film. We said, oh, that's a vehicle for Willis. So maybe that's what will happen with the next Hangover film. They'll find some crazy makeup.
Either that, or what you could do to make it work is kind of give it some time and space, and then once these characters have kind of grown, because pretty much the whole cast is people that are unknown.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like none of those characters were pre-established, you know, hot tickets.
It's true.
They were all newcomers, and it's like if you let those guys go out and Zach manages to do something with his career, Bradley Cooper ends up branching out into something extra, and God knows what's going to happen with what's his face,
Ed Helms.
Yeah, Ed Helms. And
he's
sort
got
of
a TV series or something coming out, doesn't
he's
he?
He's got a TV series, and he's in a movie that's coming out later this year called Cedar Rapids, I think.
Ooh. Oh, okay.
And
sort of if you took all that sort of momentum and then tried to like bring it back in later on in their lives, you know, like bring in like
what they need to do
done.
Is the do those characters. They need to do those characters, but not as a Hangover now.
Exactly.
Do something else with them, you know? Because they can be a funny group of guys doing something else, you know?
Or even trying to trace down their kids' night or something like that. Like, have the same sort of
the Hangover of the Next Generation.
Yeah. But, like, have them trying to find out what their kids have done or something. Like, you know, really kind of, like, move away but still keep the same formula, because that's what people are going to want to see.
They open a detective agency.
Oh, there you go!
You're fired. Get out.
Okay, I'm gonna put a fork in it and basically say we're done. And I'm gonna say that we like to go through and basically say, do we recommend this? Now, this is where we come down to our final conclusions on this. And I'll say, if you were to go to your friends and say, you know, and they say, what do you think of this movie? What are you gonna say to those people, Richard?
Look, I'm gonna say, if you like the first one, it's a no-brainer. You'll probably like a fair chunk of the second one. Is it the funniest comedy of the year? No.
Where does it stand against the first one?
I don't think it's as fun. I don't think it'll stand up as long as the first one.
Right.
But it's still fun. And I think at the end of the day, as you said at the top of this, you know, the principal job of a comedy is to make people laugh. Mm. And, you know, for the most part, it does.
Yeah, look, I think if you buy into the world, if you like the raunchy comedy, and this film is raunchy. It is actually raunchier than the first one.
Well, there's a lot more Thai ladyboys
in
this one.
Oh, yeah. They really pushed the boundaries on good taste on several occasions on this one. And they actually made a point of it at the screening we went to see, where they came out and said that the first time around they had to blur or censor the photos in the end credits because of censorship. This time they haven't had to do that.
Mm.
And, yeah, even some of those photos are pretty out there. Stick through the credits, guys. All right. it's raw. It's raunchy, but it's not original. And I think the biggest flaw of this film is the fact that we've been there before.
Yep.
Mm.
But with that being said, I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. I don't think it's as solid as the first one. It's not as unexpected as the first one was, but it's amusing. And it made me laugh out loud on several occasions. I'd recommend it to people who like the first one.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it, but because everybody knows I hate comedies, I'm just going to say don't watch it.
But your opinion doesn't count in this case.
It never does. It's not the point. I'm still going to say it.
But let's make your opinion let's make your opinion count, and let's go on to our second feature film review. We talked about this last week or 2 weeks ago.
I can't remember. Last week was when we said that it was available.
Right, okay. Yeah. So last week, we actually played the trailer last week and everything. We're going to play the trailer again, so sorry if we feel like we're doubling up here, but we are reviewing it now. So the film we're going to review is The Tunnel, which is the new Australian low-budget film. Now, I don't think you've had a chance to see it yet.
No, I haven't, actually.
Got to get you to see that. It's directed by Carlo Ledesma and written by Enzo Tadeschi and Julian Harvey. It stars... Now, I'm not sure how to pronounce this. It's Belle Delia, I think it is. Andy Rodera... God damn, these names.
Get easier names.
Andy Rodera... Steve Davis and Luke Arnold. There you go. Luke Arnold's nice and easy.
Davis isn't bad either.
Sorry, and Steve Davis is fine. An investigation into a government cover-up leads to a network of abandoned train tunnels deep beneath the heart of Sydney. As a journalist and her crew hunt for the story, it quickly becomes clear the story is hunting them. Mm. And the source is from IMDb directly.
As good as the first one.
No, it's not as good as the first one. We need to have Joey Grass 25 write them all. All right, here's the trailer for the tunnel, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about this.
The plan from the start was, when we got to the tunnels, was to get to the lake, because that's where the story was.
Okay, through here.
Through there?
Yeah.
It's a bit tight down there, Tubby. You reckon you're going to make it?
Directly below one of Sydney's busiest train stations is the forgotten water resource that's causing all the controversy. Yeah, nothing stood out to start off with. It was quite normal.
Hey, Tangles, something wrong with the light. Is there something stuck on it?
Shit! How did I not see that coming?
I was starting to feel there was something not quite right.
Bell out, Moss.
Right, so that's the tunnel. Now, this film, before we get on with a review, we'll just remind people this is a low-budget Australian film that Andrew Denton had a hand in getting up. It's Zapruder's Other Films was one of the production partners involved in it. It was shot in and around Sydney and in the tunnels underneath Sydney. It was shot raising money by selling frames of the film. Each frame was worth $1, and they tried to raise, or are trying to raise, $135,000 by selling 135,000 frames of film. Mm-hmm. They released it quite there's no precedent for this at all, but they just turned around and released it for free on BitTorrent and basically said, it's free for all. If you like it, buy it on DVD or tell your friends to go and download it or buy some frames or what have you. Josh and I pulled it down. We had a look at it. It is completely legal. Follow the link in our show notes, and you'll be able to download a purely
free copy. Let me reestablish that. This film is free.
Free. Free
so
and legal
to download.
There's no
reason not to watch this.
Absolutely.
How much is it costing it?
Free.
Now, there is no cost. Thank
now,
you.
The question is it any good?
It is always a question. It was the question that even we wanted to know.
We wanted to know, so we got around to watching it this week, and Josh, what did you think?
Well, look, everybody knows that horror is kind of my main sort of
drive. It's your thing, man.
Yep. And look, I mean, I was one of those things where it was, for me, I went into that film going, I'm going to judge this as nicely as I possibly can. Now, that's difficult for me, mainly because...
You're a bitter, twisted person?
That, and you know that... I have a lot of the problem with the way that Australian film is made. And I was worried, as anyone would be, that you'll end up with a whole bunch of NIDA students. I'm aiming directly at you guys, making a film.
Yeah,
which
we've
is
had this
shot,
discussion before. Yeah,
we've shot 1,000 times before, and I'm not going to harp on that. But what I'm saying is, so I went in very, very jaded on this movie to start with. And I have to say that they did a fantastic job, and it's so nice because it just feels like it smashed that shell of what is Australian film. Mm. Like, it's not too much like what you would expect out of an Australian film. There's not too much drama.
In other words, it's not a kitchen sink drama.
Exactly. And as rare and
scary. And it's not a historical film. It's not a costume piece.
Exactly. No, it really, it works. The characters, some of them are unlikable, some of them are likable, but that works in the film's favor. That's what they're trying to establish. They're trying to get these people that are journalists, and they're very much like journalists. You know, they have a drive and they're not interested about, breaking that.
But I think most importantly for a thriller, It's tense.
Oh, dude, tense as fuck, man.
It is a tense, effective thriller. In fact, there were moments where I found myself kind of squirming in my chair.
Yeah, you know? And it's that great kind of, to bring it back to that descent kind of filming, where it's like, it's when something's in frame, it's strategically in frame. It's not shot cheaply with a camera swinging around for effect. It's gone... How do we make this effect work? Light goes across now. You know, like no scene feels like it wasn't planned.
And it's not just a from the camera point of view film. There are elements of that in it. And from the trailer, you'd be forgiven for thinking this is another Cloverfield or another Blair Witch ripoff. But it's not. There are actually moments where all three characters are on screen at the same time. There are just moments where they run through one night vision camera. There are moments where you're looking at, through at the other camera. But and it's like they use whatever works.
It's not first person, and it's really nice to see a film break that concept, because it's not like you've got the one character you can't see moving the camera like this. A lot of the time it's just being used for light, so all of your characters are in front, or you've got the camera kind of facing up as people talk in a group. And it,
that's right, and they use the first person. They can then use that first person camera effectively for particular scenes, and it means something because it's not the whole film.
Exactly.
So, you know, I thought it was a very effective film. I thought it, I thought there, look, it gives away its low budget origins at times. There are a couple of actors who you sit there and go, boy, just a recast on those few people and we might have been there, you know? There are a couple of scenes where you sit there and go, with just the benefit of a little bit more money, a little bit more time, you probably could have just done a little bit better with that. But on the most part, a good 85 to 90% of this film, I was there with them.
Yeah,
I was there with the characters. It was a tense situation. It is genuinely scary. Second half of the film, genuinely scary. You don't know what's going on, and they don't either. And you're discovering it together. You know?
And also, it's not that strategic kind of situation you set up in horror movies where you've got the one character that survives and then everyone else gets killed off. It's like you're not sure of what's happening. You know the people that are going to survive. So it kind of alleviates that whole you're not wondering who's going to die next.
And it's a really interesting setup, because in the opening scene of the film is a police call. And in that police call, she's saying, he's bleeding, we're on a train platform.
Yeah.
So right there at the beginning of the film, we know one of them is going to be hurt.
Yeah.
Then it's done in documentary style where they're actually recalling the events. And so you keep seeing the people talking about it. So you're trying to figure out who's missing from the people talking, you know? Because you're trying to figure out who was bleeding on the station, who was in... And you start to very quickly piece together who... is missing from the party, so to speak.
No, absolutely.
You know, and then it's just a matter of how did this happen?
Exactly.
And I think it's very, very cleverly done, very cleverly written.
I think they picked a good section of actors. I mean, you have good people in good roles. Tangles, as you were saying, is a very well-made character.
Yes.
He's very likable, but he's offset by the different types of characters. You've got that. It's almost introspective of them looking at Australian culture, because you've got the larrikin-style guy who's one of the...
And I was about to say, he was a really interesting character. I don't know all of their actors, because they're pretty much unknowns. But the guy who was the cameraman, who was the larrikin, he spends the first 20 minutes of the film talking to camera in the documentary style. And he's kind of laughing about it and joking about it. And all stuff.
He comes across as a bit of a dick.
And as the film starts to unfold, you can actually see him starting to relive these moments. And you start going, oh, this did affect you. And you've been covering this up with laughter and being a larrikin. And there is much more to it. I actually really, really, really enjoyed this film. I thought it was actually very effective.
I'm a little bit sad only in the fact that there are not enough people that are supporting this film. I mean, when I say that, it's amazing the response that it's got, considering that it is such a different style. We haven't done something like this, and it is such... a standalone project.
And it's a far cry. I mean, we saw, what was that film? The Loved Ones.
Yeah.
Which we actually refused to even review on the show. It was so bad. We hated it. We hated that film so much that we actually thought if we review this, we're going to offend somebody.
Yeah.
Because it was, we were so angry by the time we left the cinema. In fact, we almost had to tie Josh down from not leaving the cinema.
And I have problems
with it. We'll have to come back to that one.
Yeah. You may have offended me.
Yeah, well, the thing is, the reason that I had such a problem, the reason that there is a difference for me between these first two films is the same reason, is that I'm not a fan of gore for gore's sake.
Mm.
And I don't believe in a film that's just trying to drive
me to this is coming from a guy who likes horror films.
Yes, like, dude, you can put the most violent, disgusting shit in front of me. I will not have a problem with it as long as there's a point to it. There has to be a point. There is no point in Loved Ones, which is my issue with it. It just feels like the whole thing is just how can we make people feel uncomfortable for a whole film? Whereas this is genuinely trying to...
Yeah.
In this film, we barely see any violence. There is blood, and there are people that die... But it's not like these...
And it happens so suddenly.
Exactly. That, yeah. It's all about driving you to that point by making you part of the group, making you fear for what's around you. And it's like, this is horror, right?
Whereas the Loved Ones actually was not scary in any way, shape, or form from beginning to end. You just sat there going, why?
Yeah,
why?
I just all the way through it.
I sat there going, "Why? What's the point in this? This is just like a pointless exercise."
Everybody's favorite scene from the film is where with the drilling in the head, and it's like the whole scene for me. I was just sitting there going, "Can we just finish? I don't care whether or not he dies. I didn't like the characters.
Another major factor with the Loved Ones was there wasn't actually a very good performance out of anybody out of a group of fairly unlikable actors.
There was no one to root for. No one to root for. Yeah.
Exactly.
And the problem was that the acting was actually substandard. I mean, the girl got all this acclaim for being the psycho girl. I thought was terrible. Mm. I felt like she was in some sort of acting class the entire time going, look at me, I'm being crazy, you know?
But that was the thing. I didn't buy her craziness. And the whole thing is it feels like that really kind of like uneducated kind of acting. And that's the problem. It's like, as an example, as a New Zealander, everybody raves about... fuck that one. The cook me some eggs, bitch. Help me out here.
Once for warriors.
Thank you. And the first half of
that was on the poster, I believe.
But it is the famous line from it. But the first half of that film, acting wise, is atrocious. Mm. It's just horrible. It's just a bunch of kids stuck in front of a camera and given lines. Like, no one's trying to be a performance. They're just playing themselves.
But when that film kicks in...
When that film kicks into overgear, that's a different story. But that's the difference. You know, it's like with this, I never felt that. I felt like it was like a performance.
Oh, this is Loved Ones we're talking about. Yeah, Loved Ones.
I felt like it was a high school play.
Yeah.
Whereas this...
That's a perfect analogy. It felt like a high school play.
Exactly. Whereas the tunnel feels... Everyone in that film feels like they're driving a role. And you actually get in... Like, you've got these people playing performances of how they would act under pressure when scared shitless.
Yeah.
And each one of them plays their characters perfectly. You can imagine each one of these people acting like that.
And even the lead girl, who both you and I found quite irritating, but it suited her character.
Oh, dude,
because she was a completely irritating person.
She was doing a great performance. Her reactions and just her little subtle looks whenever she's doing something that she knows she doesn't. She's just completely cowardice.
And there's that look on her face, and this is, I'm trying not to spoil it, there's a minor spoiler, I guess, but the look on her face when the guy says, if we don't report in, then they'll call for help.
Yeah.
And he turns to her and he goes, you did tell him where we were going. And she just, the look on her face is almost like a kid who's had their hand in the cookie jar. And he's like, you did tell somebody where we were. You know? Yeah.
No, and I mean, that's the great thing about it, is that, like, I mean, it's not breaking any barriers. It's not the world's most amazing film, but you base it on the fact that it had almost no budget and that they're trying to do something which has never been done before. They're taking the concept of free movies and seeing whether or not it'll work.
Yeah.
This is like bringing cinema down to a TV
And we're
level.
Lucky in the sense that as a free movie, it even stands up as a paid film.
And I will be buying it on DVD.
Yeah, had this come out in the cinemas and we had seen this, we would have said, this is a perfectly adequate
Yeah, low and it will go in my horror. It will go in my horror collection, yeah. And I really hope it makes the money back. I actually have pulled up the website now, and out of the 135 friends, they have pulled 41,000. But if you look down, people are paying $25, $15. Mm. Some there's $100, $250. Like, there's a lot of people forking out a lot of
Josh
money
and I,
for
as
this.
Soon as we watched this, we both plunked down $5 each on this thing. So
I'm
would
moving,
say,
so if anybody's going to call me cheap, shut up.
And you can call me cheap
I don't
because,
have any money.
And you can call me cheap because I am.
I just don't have any more money to spend, but I want to buy it on DVD
as well.
But
look, even if you went in and bought a frame of this film, that's still one more dollar towards their goal and hopefully more films along this model.
And anyone that says that this sort of system can't work just needs to look at that. We have $41,558 right now that people have forked out to give for this film. Like,
and then on top of that, you can buy the DVD, you can buy a collector's edition with all sorts of printed material, you can buy the soundtrack for the film. We were actually playing part of the soundtrack at the break. You know, it's an electronica type soundtrack. It's quite good. So there are many ways to support this film. And I'm right behind this because we've been very harsh on Australian film on this show. Australian film and I don't always see eye to eye. And this is a step in the right direction. This is a step where we say, I've said this, Richard hasn't been on the show, so I'll say it again, but I actually had words once with the head of the Australian Film Finance Commission back 10 years ago or more. I don't know, it's probably not even the same guy anymore. When I said, why aren't we making more films that are universal appeal? And he actually said, point blank, he said, we don't make genre films in Australia. Wow. We make Australian films. That doesn't even make sense.
No.
You know, and that's the problem is you sit there and look at it and go, it is so narrow-minded. Yeah. We had, at one point, a friend of mine was heavily involved in Death in Brunswick, and he was hearing behind-the-scenes story. The Death in Brunswick script had been submitted to the Film Finance Corporation. It had been rejected as being too commercial and too this and too that. And they said, go back and rework it and then try and submit it again. So they took it back, and then they just resubmitted it. Same name and everything. Yeah. And it got approved. Yeah, you know, yeah. So you sit there and go, you guys are, problem with this country is funding. It's always been the funding bodies. If you are forced to go out there and find the money yourself, and this country has lots of money, money is not the problem.
Yeah.
It's about getting people who are willing to part with their money.
Yeah.
And if you are forced in a situation where you are forced to make money,
yep.
then you will make a better product.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's...
Well, a couple of years ago, there was Undead.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
And that was self-funded, and well, they raised the money themselves, and that was a terrific genre picture, and it had a big international audience as well. It got massively exported.
Yeah, so film industry and I have, in this country, the film industry and I I actually made a vow a while ago, and it's hard, and I've actually broken it a couple times over the last year, but I actually vowed I wouldn't pay another cent at the cinema for an Australian film, because I was just burned so often. So I was catching up with it on DVD and stuff like that, because I just didn't want to spend cinema dollars on product that I kept getting burned by, you know? Now, I've broken that a couple of times, because I saw Australia and Tomorrow When the War Began. As you can see, I still get burnt.
Yes.
Every time.
So I don't think Australia was the one to break you.
But this is what I'm saying. It's like films like this prove that there is another way to do this. And opening up, especially because we are right now the people that are getting behind this. We need to push the concept, because it's right here in our hometown.
Yeah.
This is starting in Sydney. And it's like, if you're watching this, if you're listening to this, if you're a podcast listener, please just go out and download it. It's not even that big. The standard definition version is, what, 700 meg? Yep.
Standard movie length. For anybody who downloads torrented stuff, you'll know that.
Exactly. They have information on how to
the
download it.
The high-def version's only 2 gig.
Exactly.
Yes, so. Exactly right.
Go out, get this film, and watch it. And look, honestly, I think if you're a horror fan, you're going to get your money's worth.
Yeah, well, exactly.
for starters. And then even if you do like it, throw down $1, $2, go to the website and give them some money. If we can make this work, then we'll see more of it happening.
All right, bottom line is this: it is not the most sensational film ever made. We've been talking so much, I think we've lost sight of the fact that it's not the greatest film ever made, but it is a really entertaining film. It is a very tense good example of the horror genre, and it is well worth the time to download it and watch it for free. Have we said that one more time? So, you know, you don't even have to fork out some money to see this one. This one is a free download. Go grab it, have a look at it, because I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Mad. Yeah, absolutely. And I just think we can't push that enough. Please go out and support this, because Australia needs this.
Yes.
Right on the body, we need to restart this film industry because it's dead, okay? And this is the revival right here.
All right, so if anybody who's directly involved, and I'm going to put this call out because we did this for Iron Sky and suddenly they contacted us. So if anybody's involved in the production of The Tunnel who has listened to this, please, by all means, get in touch with us. We'll have you on the show in a heartbeat.
Absolutely.
All right? So we're going to try and track some of these guys down. I think it's high time we talk to these people. All right, let's move on to some entertainment news. Okay, Total Recall. the remake that should never happen has got some new cast members. And funnily enough, surprise, surprise, Kate Beckinsale's been cast in it.
Oh, she's everywhere.
Well, not just that. Her husband's directing it.
Got a habit of that, hasn't she?
Len Wiseman is directing the remake of Total Recall, which surprisingly does not take place on Mars.
Really?
Has nothing to do with Mars.
Where's it taking place?
On Earth. It's gone back to it's gone back to the original source material.
Oh, so we can remember it for you wholesale.
Yeah. So it's got nothing to do with Mars. The two female cast members have been cast. Jessica Biel will be playing Rachel, who was played by Rachel Ticotin in the first one, and Kate Beckinsale will be playing Laurie, Sharon Stone's character. But the big piece of news, the one that I really liked, was that Bill Nighy has been cast as Quato.
Wow, isn't that a stretch for him?
It's no stretch, but I just love watching him on screen.
Yeah,
you don't have to go far to find Bill Nighy.
No, that's true.
Turn around on your own set and oh, shit, you're here?
When did you arrive? all right, so that didn't thrill you. Okay, so how about Bane? He's on screen for those who can see him now.
Isn't it interesting that Christopher Nolan can give me one picture and I can literally spend half an hour looking at it and thinking about it? Like, I have spent so much time staring at this picture, it is ridiculous.
And it's already iconic. I mean, that's the thing. It's, I was dubious about the inclusion of Bane into that world.
So was I.
And, you know, the thing is, because I think the first two Batman films Christopher Nolan's done have been so grounded. So how do you bring in...
Basically a supernaturally type character.
And that's how you do it. He looks
he's believably big, though.
There's been talk about his mask, and they're saying that is it possible that what it is they're going more with the Scarecrow kind of idea, where it's like a gas that he's basically inducing himself with that gives him like PCP type strength, you know, and so, which is all grounded in much more a much stronger sense of reality than having himself inject himself with a serum that turns him into a huge hulking monster. You know,
well, the last guy died, didn't he? The last guy who played Bane?
Did he die? I seem to remember
the guy who on Batman and Robin.
Did he die? I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah, I think he may have been juicing himself.
Well, like, the whole thing is that Bane, either way, is more a character that is sort of about the idea of being ridiculously about injecting himself with this stuff. Like, he's an absolute prisoner of the serum.
Yeah.
And, like, I think that's really the thing. Like, Christopher Nolan is about the character inside the mythology. He's not about necessarily, you know, sort of the giant monsters or Poison Ivy or something like that. Yeah. It's all about what this character is at its core. You know what I mean?
And what I'm hoping is that Christopher Nolan is going this. And the fact that he's cast Tom Hardy to play Bane says that he is going the way of the comic books, which rather than the Batman and Robin movie, which was terrible, Bane is actually an intelligent person.
Yeah.
He is a very intelligent person, and he is the man who broke Batman's back. You know, I mean, this is the man who brought Batman down, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think we're going with that very intelligent Bane. We're going with the, you know, he's muscle and brains, and so I'm very keen. This image was part of once again, Batman: The Dark Knight Rises is getting the whole viral campaign. This was people were finding the pieces to this, and they pieced this together until finally the image was revealed, and now the image is everywhere. So I think we'll be seeing more
including
and more
including our own website, I believe.
Absolutely, we have it up. And if you think about it, this is very similar to when The Dark Knight came out. The first image was the Joker.
Mm.
And we had that image of the Joker that was found and slowly revealed.
Yeah.
All right. So with that, we also have, speaking while we're on superheroes, we have the new Green Lantern trailer. Now, I've put this up on the site. If you want to go see this in detail, you go to geekactually.com. This was a trailer that was presented to the 3D cinemas. Right. So this was basically their 3D trailer. And all I can say to that is this should have been the damn trailer from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
Because this is now a film that is in my top four films for the summer season. Now I want to see this movie, where I was kind of iffy on before.
Well,
but
this is a brand new trailer for me, as I don't have the net, so let's do this.
So let's do this. This is the new Green Lantern 3D trailer.
Billions of years ago, a race of immortals harnessed the most powerful force in existence. The emerald energy of willpower. These immortals, the guardians of the universe, built a world from where they could watch over all of existence. The planet Oa. A ring powered by the energy of will was sent to every sector of the universe to select or recruit. In order to be chosen by the ring, it was said one must be without fear. Together, these recruits formed the Intergalactic Peacekeepers, known as the Green Lantern Corps.
We want war! We want war!
The gravest threat the Corps ever faced was Parallax, an entity that fed on the yellow power of fear. After defeating the Corps' finest warrior, the search for a successor began.
Choose well.
And for the first time, the ring chose a human.
Become one of us.
I love that last shot of him taking off.
Just generally, that's a fucking great trailer.
That is so much better than
the first 16.
But you know.
So true. Look, they finally got it right.
Well, like the other thing,
you put enough clips in the movie in.
It's interesting because what they've tried to do with the trailer campaign is they've tried to ground it with things that people know about the show. And like, as someone that wasn't a Green Lantern fan, someone gave me one of the comics and I've fucking forgot the name of it, something Dawn or something like that.
Emerald Dawn.
I think so. Anyway, it's a story where he goes, his character goes rogue.
Yeah. We were talking about this the other night.
And it's an interesting thing because it's like, when you read it, the first half of the comic was me being like, I'm still not into this. And it's the final shots of the comic, which has this epic psycho war that breaks out in different colors, that sort of led me into the point where I was like, wow, this is actually amazing because it's such a deep and detailed thing. And it's like, until you show people the amazing thing, until you avatar that shit, until you just go, this is the fucking world of Green Lantern, and you're just like, holy fuck, what is this? It's just those city shots of the world that they live on.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you know, the shots of like the fighting between those people and the big heavy duty scenes of, you know, parallax and stuff like this. Until you see this, you can't get into it.
No.
You know what I mean?
Well, up until now, it's been, you know, him on Earth in his kind of rather silly looking costume.
Yeah.
And doing
being
rather
Ryan Reynolds.
Being Ryan Reynolds. And it looked, I mean, the first trailer looked like a romantic comedy with him and, you know, him and her in bed together and stuff. And it's now we're starting to go, this is epic.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a big epic story. You, and here's the story laid out for you.
You can't pull your punches with something like this. It's like, if you want the viral shit to work, you've got to sell us what will make us go and see Green Lantern.
I was going to say, the thing that you said before was world. They've created a world with this one. And it's something that DC hasn't been really good at doing.
No.
Up until this point.
Oh, wow. That is so true.
And Marvel's done it so well up to this point, and they've really sold you the fact that, like, you see this movie, you're going to get into all these other movies as well, and we're going to give you the fucking Avengers at the end of this thing.
Yeah.
You know, DC haven't done that. This is actually, look, as a comics fan and as a longtime DC comics fan, that's the trailer I wanted to see.
Yeah.
It's the, I mean, I think, that's absolutely it. That's the comic I've been reading for the last 15 years or whatever. And, you know, I, as you said, it's now shot straight to the top five movies for the rest of the year. It's it's absolutely deep.
Yeah, no, it's right up there in the collection of the Captain Americas and the Harry Potter part two. And we're right up there now. You know, it's one of the big geek films now of the year. So whereas before it was kind of like everything else. Oh, yeah, and Green Lantern.
Yeah. You know?
But now it's right up there.
Yeah.
All right. Who is a fan of Riddick?
Riddick?
Yeah. Yeah.
Chronicles of? Yeah.
You see, I go a lot deeper, you know. But then also the opposite side of things as well, because it's like, I love Riddick, and I loved Riddick's progression. I was such a fan because I watched the movie, and I watched Pitch Black, and I think Pitch Black stands alone as an amazing horror film.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a horror film.
Pitch Black.
It's all, it's tense, and it's claustrophobic, and it's all about these, you know, dark places, and Riddick is this character that's like the ultimate middle guy, and I love the way that his character's always outside every conversation. He's always, you know, he's the guy that just sits there and watches how it plays out and just deals with himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, we got Escape from Butcher Bay, which was the game, and the game was a great storyline. Like, forget gameplay. If you sat behind someone and watched it, it was really interesting because you just... you were walking through this world. You were doing what Riddick does best. You were avoiding contact, and you were trying not to get found and all this sort of stuff, and you were hiding. And that was what Riddick did. And then we had Chronicles of Riddick, and that did none of that.
Well,
and
I actually rewatched
the Chronicles. You did have Judy Dench, though.
I actually rewatched the Chronicles of Riddick about a week ago, and... I'd forgotten what a mess that movie is.
That's the problem with it. It's a mess. It's like, I want to like it because the world that they set up, I don't hate. It's just that the film's not shot well. It's not organized well.
And it's really hard to believe it's the same director as Pitch Black. It really is. It really doesn't feel like it. All right, so David Twohy is the one that we're talking about. He's the director of both the Riddick films. Now, he and Vin Diesel have been talking about doing a third Riddick film for years. And they've never been able to get this deal off the ground. Apparently, Twohy has now basically been given a green light for a third Riddick film. If, there's a big but attached to this, if Vin Diesel will work for scale. So Vin Diesel has now gone to his Facebook page and put it out to the fans, basically saying... This is a big... He goes, I love the character and I love the world and we want to do this, but is it worth my while? Because basically what he's saying is the second Riddick film only took $60 million.
Right.
Do I work at scale, work for all this time making no money, and then you guys turn around and avoid the film, you know? I think is what he's trying to say is, if you guys are going to come and see the movie, I'll do this. So there could be a third Riddick film. Now, this is the most important part. It looks like they could probably green light a third Riddick film with him earning more, but both him and Twohy want a hard R. Now, this will put it back into Pitch Black territory.
Yeah.
The studio will only let them do a hard R if he works for scale. So they're basically saying, if you keep the costs really low, we'll let you do this hard R, because no hard R film seems to have actually done very well in the last year.
Let's put this film in perspective for a moment, because unless they prequel it, how do you guys feel about the fact that technically he's an immortal god of a race of people now?
I would actually like to see a film that led up to the events of Pitch Black, is what I would like to see.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like, I think prequels...
And if they're going for hard R, yeah, then maybe it should fit in with that Pitch Black.
Where he is a criminal, where, absolutely, you know, and all this sort of stuff, and why he was there.
Mm.
That's what I would like to see.
Yeah, no, because, I mean, like, we've got this great world. I mean, one of the things that's really special about Riddick as a character is you've got, like... Like the lead up, sorry, I missed one. Dark Fury, the other one, the cartoon comic they did. And look, although the end changes style completely and goes a little weird, it was a cool concept. Again, weird alien creatures and bizarre sort of like bounty hunters and all this. And these characters, like Tombs, that's in every film. And he's awesome, like as a sort of side character. And it's like, I would love to see more of these things. I'd love to see them bring back the Junkie. Bring back his captor. Because he was a great character as well. He was that kind of lawman with obvious flaws. And it's things... It was things. It was like... It was a dirty, dark world. It wasn't a superhero film. It was a dirty,
which is
dark,
what the Chronicles of Riddick became. Yeah, exactly. The Chronicles of Riddick is one of those films where it's so overproduction designed that they seem to have forgotten that they needed a script to go with that. You know, it's like... So, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with this at this point. They're saying that he does have a little bit of street cred at the moment because Fast Five was huge.
Oh, absolutely.
So Vin Diesel does have a little bit of clout right now.
Mm.
I think it's interesting. So I think whichever way we slice it, there's going to be a Riddick film coming. But
what I like is that Vin Diesel likes the character. You can tell that. Yeah. Like he likes – it goes back to what he started at, which was the fact that he was a hardcore image. That was what one of the things that drove him. And he got to play a badass.
Yeah, and
he likes that. And I would like to see him do that again, but that's what I want to see. Like even the picture you've got there at the top, that's new Riddick. And – that doesn't work for me. No. Like, he looks like a cartoon character, and he looks friendly. And that's not what I like. I liked him dirt-covered.
Pitch Black, he felt dangerous.
He was dangerous. He was likable, though, because it was like, as long as you're not in his way, he's not coming after you. Mm. He's not a serial killer. He's just not really that worried about anyone but himself.
Yeah.
And he's seen dark stuff. I want to see what dark stuff Riddick's seen.
Be interesting to see where this goes. So...
So what's the general consensus? Do we want this?
I want it if they go the hard R.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I want it if they go back to Pitch Black.
Agreed. I think, you know, if they I think this is the problem that they have with these. They have a really successful first entry, and then there's this temptation to take it up a notch for the next one. And it's exactly what they did
they took it up about five notches.
They took it up about five notches. Yeah. And the problem is because Vin Diesel's star has risen so much since then. And as you said, Fast Five is a massive film. They're going to want to play to that. And you know, maybe it's not even possible for him to do that kind of Pitch Black sort of film anymore.
When Pitch Black came out, he was one of many characters.
Absolutely.
He didn't come across as, like, the star until about halfway through the film when he started to take charge.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So...
Well, at the same time, we didn't know him back then.
Well, that's right.
That was the other thing. Like, at the time, Vin Diesel was just... He was a set of really good performances for me, and that was the thing. He was never in that good a film, but he had things like Knockaround Guys, where he has a few really awesome scenes, like him as a person, terrible films. And it was sort of like we were starting to notice him, but Vin Diesel was not the drawing card of this film at the time. Like, he was just, I went to see Pitch Black because it was Bad Things on a Planet.
I went to see Pitch Black because people were saying it was like the original Alien. It was dark and it was tense, and you know. And I thought that sounds good. You know, I haven't seen a film like that for a while, so let's go see that. And it was great. I really enjoyed the first Pitch Black.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. It's just sad because it's like I would love to see more of this kind of shit.
Well, he's saying he's not adverse to doing the whole scale thing. He said when he did the film,
there's a huge amount of cred coming straight from me just due to
the fact that he's considering it.
No, the fact that he's putting it out that way. He's like, guys, should I do this? It's like the fact that he gives a shit about his fan base. He's like, dude, I'll do this if you.
Because he said
it's
when he did the film Find Me Guilty, he worked for scale, because he loved the project so much, and he did it, and he said it was a great experience to do that. So he's not averse to doing that. Yeah. He just wants to know because
money is always second to art. Exact quote, and that's great. Like that's the way a real actor should be. It's like you should want to pick your role before you pick your paycheck. And
absolutely,
yeah. For that reason alone, I'm interested to see what he could do with another one.
All right. Let's see. Sorry, I was saying, if they just don't go the ways of Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah.
David R. Ellis. Here's a name that should strike fear into your heart.
We all remember my last conversation about David R. Ellis.
Okay, so David R. Ellis, for those who don't know, is the guy who directed Snakes on a Plane.
Right. I knew the name.
All right,
That wasn't my problem.
Which wasn't the problem. He then went on to direct the fourth Final Destination film. The problem.
Twitch.
Twitch.
Man, the venom I spewed on that show.
Yeah, no, we none of us were particularly happy with that film, but Josh was angry.
Oh, man, by the end of that show, I tore a hole in the... I don't think you can hear the end of that. I think it's just black noise.
Yeah. So I have the trailer for his new film. It's Piranha 3D 2. No, sorry. It's Shark Knight 3D. That's what it is. So he's decided to make this...
Is the 3 or the D backwards? I'm just curious.
No, it's just okay. Shark Knight 3D. But
I'm new to this too. So.
My comparison...
I'm all ready for this.
My comparison to Piranha 3D is justified. Please watch.
We are going up to Lake Crosby to Sarah Howski's house.
Are you ready for the lake?
Let's go!
Room for one more?
Yeah, totally.
Cool. Good boy.
Oh,
you guys have fun back there.
Not quite what we had in mind. Let's rock it out.
Your house is on an island?
Oh, it's going to be a good weekend.
You want to hit that out. Your secret's safe with me, man.
Now, apparently, the formula for this film is lots of boobs and lots of fish killing people, which sounds very familiar.
I'm fine with it.
I have no problem with that particular combination. No.
My confusion is in the fact that I think that goes down in the history of weirdest trailers ever made. It's like it starts out standardly horror and then just decides to throw these concepts at you in the last 5 seconds that are supposed to be intriguing. It's like maybe someone put them here. Girl in a tank. Dude being lowered into the water, and I'm just sitting there the whole time going, what the fuck do these have to do with what I just saw? Why is this guy here, and why are they trying to kill the sharks? It's like, there's too much of me going, what? It's intriguing. I'll watch it. Yeah, no, for sure. I want to know what that second half of the trailer is all about.
With the guy being lowered into the water.
Well, yeah, shit like that, and the fact that they have the shark cage, which obviously wasn't on the island,
because
or at least not.
They wouldn't have expected sharks in a lake to start with. So,
shark cage handy.
Yeah.
Scout's motto.
he's going outside in the hallway, man. Just in case.
That's why it took me so long to get here. I had to
You have no idea how much time it gets to get this here.
No, but stylistically, I think this is building on David R. Ellis' first film, Homeward Bound 2, Lost in San Francisco.
Is this a guy in search of a career direction at this point?
That was great, dude.
Yes, I can't
just
say.
Just Warren through from that. Like, I will make Shark Knight 3D one day.
And what I don't get, could somebody help me out? Why it's called Shark Knight?
I don't know.
When
okay,
80% is in the day.
Now, yeah. I will say for him, and I'm going to just bring up the article that this came from,
right, okay,
because
cool.
He actually had an original title for his film.
Right.
And the one thing I will give
Piranha Knight.
Oh, this isn't the right article. Yeah. It was actually called about piranhas,
but somebody stole that idea, and he's like, "Fuck! Now I'm going to have to go with something else."
So there's a series of emails between him and.
It was originally called something along the lines of Untitled Shark 3D Project.
Right.
And he actually wanted
that was an awkward title.
And he actually wanted to leave it as that title.
That would have been great.
And the studio said, "No, we really can't." But this was the same idea. Snakes on a Plane was actually the working title. It was never meant to be called that. But when people got wind of it, it became. Such a cultural thing. Everybody going, snakes on the plane. Want those motherfucking snakes on my motherfucking plane? That he basically just left the title because he said, you know, okay, well, people seem to like that title. You know? And so he, when he was working on this entire film, was shot under the title of Untitled Shark 3D Project. And he by the end of it, he said, I want to keep this title because it's funny. But they wouldn't let him, apparently. So Shark Night came about. And why Shark Night? Who knows? It's just
Day sounds like there should be a Pride March.
How about just Shark 3D?
Shark 3D.
That would work. Piranha 3D. Shark 3D. You know, there you go. That would work.
Sharkenstein.
Sharkenstein.
I don't know. All of these names are stupid and terrible. But I got to say that I love shark films because again, this comes back to what I talk about all the time. It's those primal initial fears that we all have. It's like something under the water. And those concepts sell.
And if he goes for the same formula, if he goes for the same formula as Piranha 3D with the sardonic sense of humor, the copious amounts of flesh,
that's not what you're going to get with this.
No, but this is what I want. If he can do that,
don't, because then you're going to set yourself up to fail because you're going to get something you don't want. This is something like Friday the 13th. It set up your characters.
Then in that case, that trailer is completely mismarketed.
I actually just...
Because the first half of
that
trailer
concept.
Looks like Piranha 3.
Nah, man. Yeah, honestly, the first half of that trailer for me is exactly what the trailer would be for something like Friday the 13th, where it's like, establish your characters, establish that they're all a group of horny guys going for horny girls, which is all of teenage-dom encompassed in one, like, five-second piece. And then after that, build relationships between the characters while building up a little bit of tension, and then let loose. It is an old-school horror film at its core. And that's what I'm hoping it is. And if I'm wrong, because this motherfucker has
Final Destination.
One film left, and I disown you forever. But yeah, no. Look,
because I got to say, I was not a big fan of Snakes on a Plane. Everybody else around me seemed to like it, and I sat there and I watched it, and I walked out going,
didn't like it because it's a piss take of everything that was like the 80s.
I was wanting that, but I didn't find it funny at all. And that's the problem.
I found it funny because it's just stupid.
I was actually bitterly disappointed because I was hoping for that.
Premise of it, I mean, you can't take it seriously. Like, the whole plan was to release snakes on a plane. Because that was the most efficient way of taking out one person.
Absolutely. I mean, it's flawless. It's not like people would survive something like that, you know, or that, you know, they would be able to, it's so bizarre. It's awesome.
Still tonight in our chat room, it said, give the guy a fucking compass. Are you referring to his career? All right.
That movie's going to suck, but I'm still going to watch it.
Look, I'll go see it. I love shark films. It's just that as long as it's got 3D boobs, I'm in. You know, right? Yeah. Fine. We talked about Akira last week. We said that...
Like your title for this. I actually thought that when I was reading the show notes.
Well, no.
I was like, another blow for Akira? I'm like, there is no blows for Akira. As long as it stays off the screen, I'm
happy. We meant is another blow for the live-action film version of Akira.
I know. That's what I'm saying. It's like,
it's a blow for them.
Blows.
It's a victory
for
us.
Yeah, well, exactly. What I'm saying is that it's like a body blow to these filmmakers. And the scary part is that even with all this tragedy, the film is still fast-tracked at Warner Brothers, apparently. They're really pushing this thing.
And I'm not against the concept of the movie. It's just that everything about it isn't right.
Well, okay, so last week we heard that Keanu Reeves had passed.
Hooray!
Thank God. This week, Albert Hughes has walked from the project to director. He basically has cited creative differences.
Yeah, creative differences being that it wants to be creative.
Well, being the fact that he wants to change everything from the original...
He's not creative. We can stop at that.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, all the way through this production, they kept talking about the Hughes brothers. Apparently, it wasn't the Hughes brothers. Apparently, it was one of the Hughes brothers.
Exactly, and that's the difference. It's like, it's obvious to me that he is not the creative side, because I'm sure the dialogue and story
would
be great.
Yeah, let's bring Alan Hughes back into
this. Exactly. Alan Hughes is the creative one.
Or they're creative together. It's like one of the... It's like an atom. They need the neutron and the proton to make it work.
So how did you guys feel about From Hell?
I actually didn't mind From Hell.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was brilliant, but I think it had really good stuff in it. Yeah. I think you were a little bit harder on it.
I'm a little bit harder, but I still agree. Like, I'm not against it being existing. Like, I wouldn't own it in my collection. I've seen it a couple of times. If someone ripped it out of when Shall We Watch From Hell, I'd probably sit down and watch it again.
And I think that's the big difference between between Akira and From Hell. Like, with From Hell, they could take one element of that story and make a movie out of it. I don't know how you can... I mean, they obviously have done that with the animated version of Akira, but it's just too big to... It's too big to fail.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can only imagine from everything I've heard about the live action that they are trying to basically remake the cartoon, not the graphic novel, is what it sounds like to me. They're trying to go with that cartoon, the film, and basically saying, let's remake that as a live action film.
And it's fine the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. Yeah. Exactly. Like the film, the cartoon film works as a cartoon film, and the book works as a book. They're almost separate stories. Like, they have elements of each other in it, but it's kind of more of a, this is what we got out of it, as opposed to, this is the shortened version of everything that's in this ginormous 7-volume freaking novel of a book. And it's like, I don't like the concept of them wanting to go back to this, because it's like, that's too much to cover in a film. It doesn't work. Yeah. You need to stick to the main story.
Agreed. All right, so I actually have a feeling that Akira is going to slowly die. I think it's. I don't think it's going to happen.
Hooray!
I think it's just. It seems to be sliding further and further out of existence at this point, with everybody's basically passing on it.
And angels rejoiced, I believe, with the next line.
All right, let's talk about one more trailer here, and then we're going to go into our list of five. This trailer, the only reason I'm putting it here is because I think this is a brilliant piece of marketing. Absolutely. There's been two out so far. We're only going to do one of them. We're going to do the first one. The second one I don't think is quite as effective, but it was a end up of The Hangover, and it was kind of funny in its own right. But this one in particular, because of the way Disney did it. And I want you to picture, before watching this trailer, and you can go watch the whole thing at geekactually.com, we've got it embedded there. But you go into the cinema to see Pirates of the Caribbean in 3D. You walk into the cinema, and they've even got posters for it. Now, I've got the poster on screen up in the cinema for this new rom-com called Green with Envy. You know, it's typical rom-com, Jason Segel, Amy Adams, right? And so you go in there. So you've already got this subliminal message that there's this new rom-com coming out. You sit down to watch Pirates of the Caribbean, and this trailer starts. And I just think this is so clever.
Vacation. Hi.
Hi.
Two people searching for love.
This is the most romantic thing ever. I've always dreamt of seeing Los Angeles.
One chance to go the distance.
I was just wondering what the plan was for dinner tonight.
Oh, I don't care. What do you feel like?
Okay. I'm going to go for a walk.
But sometimes...
I forgot my anniversary with Mary.
You have to break your heart.
You know when you've been trying to figure something out and you can't figure it out, and you figure it out and you're like, duh.
To find its other half.
You're my best friend.
Jason Segel.
I love Mary. I love her so much and I can't lose her.
Amy Adams.
I love you too.
Kermit the Frog.
Hi there.
Miss Piggy.
Kermit!
Whoa. Wait, stop. Are there Muppets in this movie?
Oh, yeah.
Come on, guys, let's go!
The Muppets.
Wow, that was an expensive looking explosion. I can't believe we had that in the budget.
Who doesn't love the Muppets?
The thing that I love the most about the Muppets is the fact that they have been able to incessantly take the piss out of themselves.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Ever since the first Muppet section, ever since then, it's just been a piss take. And it's just great to see them back.
Now, the reports are...
Callison's is sold.
Now, the reports are that when that happened in the cinemas, the cinema erupted. They were just like... What the hell? So they even released it on YouTube as Green with Envy.
They did.
So that nobody would know.
No, there's
so
a Facebook page.
Yeah,
there's a
quietly just snuck it out there.
In fact, on Apple Trailers, it's still just...
It's still Green with Envy?
Still Green with Envy, yeah.
That's so good.
And the second one that came out was the one that's, as I say, sent up at the Hangover, and it's done with all like the walking towards camera,
it's the fuzzy
and all
pack.
The fuzzy pack. That's right, the fuzzy pack, and all the text on screen, like you know, they're brilliant. They're this. Yeah. So it's a very clever campaign. I cannot wait to see it.
Oh, it's gonna be brilliant. We needed this movie.
Yeah, and the fact that it's written by Siegel and his writing partner from Forgetting Sarah Marshall, you just think, oh, this is just gonna be joyous. Yeah,
forgetting Miss P.
All right. That's it for news. Let's do a list of five. This week we are going to do... Oh, actually, no. I have one more thing I just want to read you really quickly. Mm-hmm. This is actually not in the show notes. It's something I came across. I've actually got it printed out here. Mm-hmm. This is actually a quote from... what's his name? Robert Pattinson. Pattinson, who I am not a big fan of, but he's actually getting my respect a little bit more and more. He's in David Cronenberg's new film.
Mm. And the great thing is there is a new... David Cronenberg.
Yes, I was about to go. This what now?
Cosmopolis is the new David Cronenberg film, and when asked about working in this film and so forth, this is what Rob Pattinson had to say, which I really, really admired. He says, "You know, there are so few auteurs left. The one thing that pisses me off about working in films is when you start a project and then suddenly, 2 days before you start, there's a massive rewrite to make an R-rated movie into something that's PG-13. Bitter towards Twilight, much? Do you think?" And it's a totally different story. As soon as that line's been crossed, you know you're not making a movie anymore. You're making a fridge magnet. But with people like Cronenberg, you know that no matter what, there will be a movie at the end, and it'll be a solid and self-contained, and it's not made for any other reason than being a movie.
Mm.
And I just think, good on you, son.
Words of respect right there.
And all I can say is, I think, and the fact that we also read a press release from him a few months ago where he basically said he was so fucking sick and tired of Twilight and couldn't wait for it to end, I have so much more respect for this man.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, like, he's the kind of guy that, we're never going to be friends, but it's that sort of, it's that sort of thing. Like, if I saw him in a room with things like Water for Elephants, which I haven't seen but I've heard is quite a good film, and a few other
James
films.
James from Melbourne hated it. He sent me a little reader of you and he really he didn't like it, but I want to see it.
Critics
it's
wise
no Twilight
critics wise it's getting good respect, and a few of the other projects he's done have been given good things. It's like he's the kind of guy that I would nod to across a room now, like it's good. Like I'm not I would acknowledge his existence.
I'd want
to
brush
now.
His hair, but you know,
I'll take a small locker
really
of it.
I don't know, maybe
his
that's
hair
why
is
I mean,
always so messy, it really bugs me. No, his hair is really messy.
Yeah, but it takes hours to get it like
I hate that style. It's the same thing I hate with girls who continually have their hair hanging in their face. It's like, just brush it out of your face.
This is kind of a weird thing to say about someone who's like one of the biggest teen stars in the world, but he's one to watch. It's like what we said at the start with Bradley Cooper. Like, you know, he needs to do that one role where it's kind of like, you know...
Well, Cronenberg
just
might be the way
up.
To do that.
Cronenberg's the way you do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That role where it's like you either take this and become an actor or you don't know? Take this.
Because
and
the one thing with Cronenberg films is you commit to a Cronenberg
film. Yeah. Absolutely. And,
Do we know the plot to this film?
Do we know the plot to any Cronenberg film that's come out?
I've seen Cronenberg films and still don't know the plot. No, I don't have a plot here, sorry. If somebody want to look it up on IMDb.
No, later.
Anyway, later. Let's do a list. Five great low-budget films. Now, because of The Tunnel, it kind of made us think. Sometimes filmmakers get their most creative when inspired when working with $0. So we've got our lists of five films, which are basically five films. Once again, they're not necessarily top five lists. They're just five films that we think are great films that were made with very little money and great deals of creativity is really what you're looking at. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So let's get started. Richard, you're our guest, so we'll let you go first.
Well, that's good, because I'm going to steal some of the ones that you've already mentioned to me before the show.
Oh, good. Okay.
Now, I had real trouble paring this down to five. I've got a small list here of about 10 or 11, so I might have a few also-rans.
Yeah, well, I've got a couple of honorary mentions as well. So let's just do a five, and then we'll talk about a few extras.
Alrighty. Well, as soon as you mentioned low budget, my mind went straight to horror.
Yep.
So I'm going to have to put Evil Dead in there.
was kind of hoping. I rearranged my list because I thought that was your number one. So I kind of tried to balance it out.
Well, am I supposed to do this in reverse order?
No, okay. There's not necessarily an order. All right, we'll make that my number five as well, okay. So we can all talk about it.
Evil Dead. It's not actually on my list, but it is a brilliant film.
Okay, well, let's bounce this.
And it was made over several years on $375,000. Mm-hmm. And it spawned, you know, a sequel, which is quite possibly one of the finest pieces of horror comedy ever.
Absolutely.
you know, it's still revered to this day.
It's a trip, too. That's what I love. It's just, it's going through his psychosis.
I love the way he raised his initial seed money. Was he made a Super 8 film, Cabin in the Woods, basically a rough version of this, took it around to all the people he knew had money in his hometown. So he took it around to dentists and lawyers and stuff like that, set up the projector in their living room, played the Super 8 film and said, are you interested in putting some money in on this? You know, great stuff, you know, just really, really unique way of raising money.
And it's still one of the most originally shot horror films to this day. That so much has been aped from that film.
Absolutely.
And he's aped himself, so it's
great. Yes.
And it led him to Spider-Man 3. So
talking about giving a man a compass.
Sawspot in the room.
Now, there's a whole lot of ones in here. There's a whole lot of other horror films.
We'll go in circles.
Five. Obviously, same things he was saying. Movie's fantastic. There's so much to watch in it. And you're right. It's just when you're on a low budget, there's so much focus on being original and using what you have to create your film as opposed to going, I need a scene with this. Who can I get to go do it for me? It's not a project of multiple people. It's a project of people wanting to create something.
And I love it. Low budget leads to low budget ideas. Like, why was Bruce Campbell the star of Evil Dead? Because it was three friends who were putting it together, and he was the best looking. Yeah. So, you know, that's why he was there, you know? And it's little stories like that all the way through Evil Dead, where you just sit there and go, this is just genius stuff, you know? If you read Bruce Campbell's book, If Chins Could Kill, he talks in great detail about the making of Evil Dead. And it just sounds like, in many ways, it was a miserable production. It was cold and it was uncomfortable and the cabin had no power. And, you know, it's like all. But the end result is so satisfying. Yeah. You sit there and go, this is what you do.
It's made with love. It's made with conviction because every scene of that would have sucked to film.
Yeah.
It's like the amount of times where he's either sitting in a wet puddle in the middle of a fucking terrible weather in the middle of the woods. It's like they really help.
And all the fake blood was getting sticky on them and they couldn't clean it. You know,
I was my favorite story from the production of this is on the fake blood. And I think it's from that book where they talk about what they used to create the fake blood. And it was basically these huge vats of KY jelly.
Yes.
And there they were out in the middle of nowhere in the woods going down to the local shops and these, you know, five or six teenagers in the woods going and buying giant vats of KY jelly. God knows what the people would have thought of them. Why are these kids taking these giant... Why are they going through it so quickly?
What takes that much of that gel? Anyway.
Yes. All right, so my number five is Robert Rodriguez's El Mariachi. Made in 92 for $7,500. Now, that figure is a bluff because the final cinema version that made it on screen had an extra $30,000 pumped into it by Columbia to clean the sound up. But still, that only makes it $37,500, and that's still pretty damn cheap. I think that you've got a guy who he made the film as a throwaway film. He was told by his screenwriting teacher that he writes three screenplays, throw them all out, and the fourth one is the one you sell. Yeah. And he decided that that was nonsense because that was a waste of time. So he decided that he would make three cheap shit films, sell them to Mexican Home Video, and from then he would then have something to as a calling card. He sold his body for scientific experiments to raise the $7,000, went down to Mexico, shot the film, and Columbia bought it. Yeah. And funnily enough, the Mexican Home Video didn't want it. So on his first shot out, he got El Mariachi, which made a great deal of money, and it spawned two sequels. I think even, you know, the sequels, Desperado is kind of fun. I still think El Mariachi is a better film than both of the sequels, no matter how much money you pour into them. It just shows you what you can do. An action film like that should not be that cheap.
No.
And he managed to find all sorts of tricks. Like, even he didn't have the right blanks to fire in an Uzi, so they would jam after one shot. And so he would create the machine gun effect in editing by just repeating the same shot over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And you'd never know, you know? And it was a very clever use of filmmaking skills to make that happen. I really liked El Mariachi a lot.
And if we're talking books on production,
Rebel
Without a Crew is absolutely essential reading for any would-be filmmaker.
There's actually a few books that we'll mention through as we go through. If Chins Could Kill is definitely a fantastic read and really funny.
Oh, it's great.
Bruce Campbell is an amazingly funny writer. And Rebel Without a Crew by Rodriguez about his journey to getting El Mariachi on screen is amazing. It's an amazing read. You just sit there and you can't believe it.
It's on my list too.
Where does it fall on your list? Number four?
It's the next one on the list, but I'm going to skip that one and... I'll just
he's going to rearrange his list.
I'm going to rearrange my list just
on the fly. This is how good he is.
Let's just go for Eraserhead because it's on there.
Almost made my list. And Josh here.
Have I taken that off Josh's list?
No. You'll never find it on Josh's list. Why would that be, Josh?
There's some history here.
I'm not a particular fan of David Lynch.
Okay, well, this is where we part company.
No, it's all good. Look, I completely agree with some people liking this kind of thing, and it is more art than it is film. I just don't gel with it. It's something that I've never really been able to describe. It's something I plan to revisit somewhere later on in life and kind of with a different clear
head. I've talked about it a few times on the show.
It's one of those things where when I watched it the first few times, I just looked at it and I was like, I think maybe films like Eraserhead are the ones that I should aim for again and just try and... My problem is that the pretension shines through for me over the top in too many of his films, where it's like I look at it and I go, you're just doing that for weird sake.
Can I put a proposal out, though?
Yeah.
Could it be that you're colored on Eraserhead because of later Lynch?
Yes, and I think this could be the
case. Absolutely.
Because I'm with Josh. I'm not a fan of later Lynch.
Yeah, and I started with the current ones, and I mean, I have the kind of mind for this kind of thing. Like, I'm a huge art fan, and I am all about the weird, and I'm all about the crazy. And
you're not going to get much weirder.
And, I mean, there are a lot of aspects I do like about Lost Highway, which is probably one of the only ones that I can actually sit down and watch because, his later films, I'm just like, no.
See, Lost Highway he'd already started. He actually lost me on
Wild
Heart.
There are elements of Lost Highway where I just go, these things are going to be used. Like, they were revolutionary and they got used in films from then on.
See, I loved The Elephant Man. I think The Elephant Man is a superb film. I loved Blue Velvet. I thought Blue Velvet was a superb film.
Blue Velvet took me a few goes to like.
Oh, really? So I saw it at the cinema way back when.
I saw it at the cinema. I was put off by the misogyny of it, or at least what I perceived to be the misogyny of it the first time.
Yeah,
I
actually that didn't.
But then I didn't get it then, and I think when you come back, and I think this is the important thing about revisiting these films.
These films are a lot like that.
Yeah.
No. But
what I had was with Lynch is, and then I really enjoyed the first season of Twin Peaks. I thought Twin Peaks was really interesting. I love The Straight Story. I think The Straight Story is a really unique little film. I really didn't like Wild at Heart very much.
No,
I thought Wild at Heart was a bitter and nasty, horrible little film. and he kind of lost me at that point. When Lost Highway came out, I was already tainted by the fact that I didn't like Wild at Heart.
See, to me, Mulholland Drive.
I hated Mulholland Drive.
See, I've obviously hit on something here, it is actually, to me, I think it's his masterpiece because it's straddling that line between the Hollywood Lynch and the guy who wants to make an art film perfectly. And it was the movie that made most mainstream audiences get into Lynch.
Do you know the funny thing about Mulholland Drive is I actually hated Mulholland Drive, and it's one of those films where everybody was saying, no, this is the Lynch to come back to, because I'd already kind of turned my back on Lynch. And everybody said, this is the one to come back to, you have to come back to him, and blah. So I sat down, and my wife and I watched it together.
Yeah.
And we sat there watching it, and the first half of that film I love.
Yeah.
The first half of that film, I'm sitting there going, this is classic Lynch, this is different, he set all this stuff in motion. And then there is a turning point in the film, and the film falls into weird for weird's sake, nonsensical Lynch, where you sit there and go, what the fuck are you doing? And then to find out after watching the film that it was supposed to be a TV series, you go, now it makes sense.
Yeah.
He set all that stuff up in that first half, and then had nowhere to take it.
Possibly.
And so the second half of the film just feels like him going, well, I can't finish this anyway, so let's just make shit up.
I can't do what I wanted. I can't do what I wanted to do with this. Yeah. So,
and then there are all these loose ends that are never come. They never come back to them because he shot the TV pilot.
Yeah.
And then he just filled in holes.
Well, you really don't want to see Inland Empire then.
I've avoided it. Yeah. I've avoided it.
It's 3 hours of that back half of Mulholland Drive.
And after Mulholland Drive, I've actually avoided it, purposely avoided his films because I just go, he has lost me.
I saw Inland Empire at the Sydney Film Festival when it came out with an audience, and there was this collective sigh of relief when it finished. And then we all realized it hadn't finished, and there was this collective gasp. Of anguish for the audience.
Dear.
But it's the only movie I've been to where just complete strangers were walking up towards their bus, their train, whatever, and just talking about it in Australia.
Yeah.
And so if nothing else, he's a talking point.
Look, it's,
well, yeah, he's always been that way, though.
Yeah.
It, look, the really kind of esoteric, like, weird kind of directors that you do get in life are always these people that you may not get the film on the first try. It's the same reason with Cronenberg. A lot of people will miss certain films or say they didn't like
it. And there's a lot of people who don't like Cronenberg, and I love Cronenberg. And Cronenberg can be weird for weird's sake as well. Don't get me wrong. Naked Lunch has some seriously twisted stuff in it, right? And you sit there and watch it, and even Dead Ringers has some seriously twisted stuff in it. You know,
yeah. Like another one is that film that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. I sat down and saw The Devil, and I actually gave it to a friend at the same time, and I didn't really like it that much. And I sat down with him a couple of days ago, and he told me his explanation of the film, and I now really want to rewatch it because I think I missed the point.
Yeah.
And it's one of those films where the second you get that.
And there's been many, and there's been many films. I will say for the record, I have seen Mulholland Drive 3 times.
Yeah.
Right.
And on all 3 occasions, I felt exactly the same way. And it's really, and it's one of those, I think I hate the film so much because I'm so frustrated by it. Because the first half is actually really solid.
Yeah.
And it has, not only is it really solid, it has an amazing performance by
Naomi Watts.
Yeah. Her audition scene is staggering, you know? And to have that level of quality in the first half and then to have it just fall apart in the second half makes me so frustrated that it fills me with bile, you know? It fills me with venom because I go, it shouldn't be that frustrating. It shouldn't be that hard, you know, to finish a film and tell some sort of coherent conclusion. There is no coherent story to Mulholland Drive by the end of the film. It is a weird, surrealistic, experimental film that I wasn't in the mood for, and I haven't been in the mood for any time I've watched it. Yeah. You know,
and look, one day it may just click.
It seemed to get people. And this is why I always say that it is worth going back and looking at films. As we've talked about many times, I hated Alien 3 when I saw it, and I've softened on Alien 3 over the years. You know, and so it's like you always go back and revisit stuff because you never know what happens. Also, there is a sense of anticipation once you go to it. A second viewing can often be a better viewing because you're no longer anticipating what you're going to get. Agreed. That's what I've said about, and I've watched 2 weeks ago, I rewatched Wolverine. Still a bad film, don't get me wrong, but I don't have the hatred for it the second time through because I'm not in anticipation of anything. I know that it's going to be bad. So now I'm looking at it for pieces. And as far as pieces are concerned, there are moments like the helicopter scene, which you go, that's Wolverine. That's great. You know, that works quite nicely. Other scenes where you go, that doesn't work at all. And that's one of those films. And that, I think I keep rewatching Mulholland Drive because I'm still trying to find what he was trying to say.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway, that's getting off our list. Let's go back to the list.
And can I just say, on that list, because this is the low-budget list, $10,000 Eraserhead.
Yeah, I read that, actually. So. I actually did look at Eraserhead for my list. I didn't put it on in the last minute because I had other things, but I did look at that. I actually really like Eraserhead. Josh and I have disagreed on this many times, but I saw it many years ago, heavily under the influence, and it's a really different film.
And to this day, he won't tell anybody how he made that. He doesn't have a book written about it, so he won't tell people how he put the creature together.
No, and he's obsessed by that sort of stuff. In fact, his DVD releases don't have chapter breaks.
No.
He actually insists that a film must be watched from beginning to end, and you're not allowed to jump into it.
Which is really hard with Inland Empire.
It's really hard with Mulholland Drive, because you just want to look at certain pieces.
You know? Yes, you do.
Yes. And I still have a grudge against him for blurring the scene on the DVD, which he didn't do at the cinema.
That's true.
But I think that was wrong. Anyway. All right, so where are we up to? My number four? No, your number four. Who are
mine? Mine. That'd be me.
Oh, that'd be you. Okay.
Mine is, and this is after two nights of debate with myself. I took it off. I put it back on. I took it off. I thought it was too easy. I don't particularly. I had other films in its place. I had Clerks at one stage.
That's true.
I had a couple of other ones, things like Swingers and stuff like this.
Yep.
But in the end, I stuck the tunnel back on there because if everything plays out the way I want it to, this will be one of those films that 10 years from now, I'm going to be like, and I said it all the way back then. It was a fucking great film.
The only reason The Tunnel isn't on my list is because it's what inspired the list. Otherwise, it would have been on the top of my list.
But like, I mean, I it was for me. It's always a kind of top five-esque kind of a situation, and it is, in my opinion, one of the best low-budget films I've seen in a long time.
Yep, fair enough. My number four is Night of the Living Dead, 1968. Yeah. $110,000. I love the story behind it. You can actually get something called the Night of the Living Dead scrapbook, I think it's called. I've got it downstairs somewhere.
Yeah.
It's actually the story of how they made it and
the making of the
it's actually called the Night of the Living Dead scrapbook or something like that. It's actually put together by the co-writer. And he kept it basically
so it's not
a
the
diary.
One that comes with it.
No. It's actually a soft cover book. I should have brought it up actually. It's really inspiring. It's really interesting to read. They initially got their seed money together by saying, if everybody invests $1,000, we have start money. So 10 people got together and each invested $1,000, and they called their company Image 10. And those 10 people invested $1,000 each, and that's how they started the whole ball rolling. This thing was so low budget that George A. Romero had to keep leaving the set to go shoot ads because he used to shoot ads for the drive-in. So he'd go off and shoot an ad, then come back and shoot another scene, then go off and shoot an ad, and then come back and shoot another scene. Hugely successful independent film, and yet Romero's made bugger all money from it because they had no idea about distribution, and he sold it all off and basically has nothing left of it. So,
And that's really unfortunate on the DVD market because we get so many shoddy versions of it.
Yeah, and so we've never really had a definitive version of this film to come out. There is a anniversary edition that came out, avoided like the plague, because the soundtrack they put on it is terrible.
Oh, it's absolutely
If you can find the original one with the library music that they put together, that's well worth having a look at. Great film. To this day, probably one of the most influential horror films to come out in quite some time at that time. All right, your number three, sir.
Right, well, I've got a lot of horror films just in here. I'm going to skip some of them. I did have El Mariachi in there at one point. I'm just going to pick one randomly from my list.
Sure, why not?
I'm going to go for Halloween on this one.
Yeah, I've got Halloween further up, so why don't I roll them around? Halloween is actually my number one, so I'll roll that back into the number two spot and number three spot, and we'll talk about that now. I bet you have Halloween somewhere, don't you? No, I'm surprised.
I knew it was going to be on everyone's list, so I tried to avoid it.
Now, Halloween, we've got a debate on the budget, don't we? Because
I've got $320,000.
That's what IMDb is listing.
Yeah.
I've heard reports up to $900,000, so we'll call it somewhere in the middle there. It's still sub-$1 million.
Either way, it's made something like $150 million, and I don't know if that includes DVD sales.
No, it's actually. I remember reading the. In box office alone, it was $100 million. So it was actually considered to be the most successful independent film of all time until Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out in the 80s, which was an independent film.
Mm.
And that made so much money at the box office, it actually knocked it off its perch. But as an independent film, it is by far one of the most successful independent, along with Night of the Living Dead, funnily enough. Great film. We've talked about it many times on the show before. This is the film that really gave birth to the slasher film.
Absolutely. It's got such a clear line through from horror history. It's got a Loomis, which has been in everything from Psycho upwards.
Yep.
And look, you know, I've got nothing but good things to say about it. You can quibble, but why bother? It's
Halloween. I've said many times before, John Carpenter is an enormous, enormous favorite of mine. He, up until his last few films, could have directed The Phone Book, and I would have gone to see it.
Yeah.
I think he was a master.
It would be John Carpenter's
phone book. But, I mean, unfortunately, he has stumbled, and this is why he went into semi-retirement, though. Yeah. I think he kind of realized that it's finished for him.
Yeah.
But he has made a comeback. Apparently, he's got The Ward that's just come out on DVD. This is a film we put a trailer up for about a month ago and said, yeah, we'll watch it. And I've just found it on the shelf at Video Easy. So it's just went straight to DVD here. So, I've got it. I've rented it, and I'm going to watch it tonight. So, Carpenter, I think this is the man, this is the film that put him in place. Mm. He had two films prior to this, but this is the film that put him in. This is the film that put him on the market, you know? Great stuff. Yeah, right there. Right there with you on that one. All right, so what number are we up to?
Because you guys put together, I've got to do one, then we have to go back to him. So,
That was a number three.
Yeah, and my number three on the list is Behind the Mask, Rise of Leslie Verzon.
How much did that cost?
That was $38,500.
Wow, that looks like it cost more.
Exactly. The film is just absolutely done by fans, and you can tell that it's just that smart kind of group of people that have just got together and gone, we need to make this film happen, it's going to be great, and everybody's just gone on board with it. And it's just like, you watch it, it's satire, it's funny, it's still horrifying.
I loved it. You gave it to me to see, and you said, you must watch this, and I loved it.
It's just everything you want in a horror film, but then also like the documentary of the film you're watching at the same time. And it's just, I've never seen it done again as well as they put that film together. And as clearly and carefully as it's done.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. Film. Actually, I just had to look it up. It looks fabulous.
We're going to have to get that film for you. But yeah, no, it's not what I expected.
It's not what you expect at all.
It's not what you expect, but you watch it and you're just like, this is amazing. And just so charming, great cast.
Yeah.
There's nothing bad to say about that film.
It's very, very good indeed. I liked it a lot. All right, who are we up to?
That's you again.
Me again. Now, I want to give you a few that are on my short list because I can't in all good conscience put this next film on the list without mentioning some of the ones that got knocked off as a result of it.
Okay.
All right. Now, look, I've put in Clerks on there, or Clerks for our American listeners. Kevin Smith's one, that was $27,000. Although, to be fair, they spent another $230,000 in post on that one.
Damn right.
Still far under a million.
Still far under a million. There's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I didn't want to put another horror film on there.
Yeah, it's difficult.
More recently, Monsters. Which was a fabulous.
He made a budget stretch a long way.
It was amazing. And look, it looks like a multi-million-dollar picture. Monsters.
I wasn't a huge fan of the film. I thought it was okay, but I love the way it looks.
It looks great. It doesn't look like a low-budget film. I've got Swingers on here as well, which is one that it launched a lot of careers, and for better or for worse.
It was those people that you got to the end of the movie, and it's like it or hate it, those are guys to watch.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's like they may not end up in places you want to see them, but they'll be around.
Mm. In which case, having mentioned all those great films, it's some trepidation that I include Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2 as number two on my list.
Honestly, I thought the way you started that, I thought you would actually put Clerks on your list.
Yep. So I couldn't in all conscience put this at number one because I've got something else saved for that. But look, this is a personal favorite, obviously. It's so low budget. It was, I don't even know if I've actually looked this up because it was a last minute decision. It's got an estimated $250,000 of the budget. I find it hard to believe they spent that much money on it. For those of you who don't know the Silent Night, Deadly Night films, there's five of them. The first one was criticized by Mickey Rooney as being horrible. This is a Santa killing series of horror films. Now, the first movie was pretty bad.
It was one of the famous video nasty range
it
of
is.
The
80s. I left all of the video nasties off my list because I thought I'd be criticized, but I should have left them on.
I had to include this because it's become a bit of a meme for me in almost everything I've done to include Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2.
It's
better
his
watch
life
out.
Force.
It is. Now, we've spoken about Life Force. But see, the thing is, the reason I find it so hard to believe they spent $250,000 on this is Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2 is made up of 80% footage from Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 1.
Yeah.
And it includes flashbacks by people who weren't even there.
And they still spent so much money.
And they spent all this money. It's got some of the best eyebrow acting. Now, perhaps they spent most of this money on product for his eyebrows to make them look perky on camera. It's got the classic line, "It's garbage day," in there. It doesn't look $1 million. It doesn't look anything other than a cheap horror film, but God damn it, I love it.
I'm going to rewatch this film. I remember seeing it way back in the 80s and it not making the impression, but it's a rewatch film now.
It's, yeah,
it is a rewatch film. All right, my number two, the list is all rearranged now, but my number two is, because I thought he was about to mention, is Clerks from 1994. This film had a lot of impact on me, and I've gone over Kevin Smith stuff ad nauseum, so I won't go into great detail. Let's just say it's his first film. It is a film that really inspired a generation. It spoke to a lot of people, and it's great stuff. So it really does need to be seen as the one that started the Kevin Smith phenomenon.
Absolutely. Did we skip me? Is that what just happened?
Probably.
Yeah.
Go to your number two.
You're really not very good with this today.
Well, we've got it because we keep rearranging the list. I have no idea what number we're up to.
All right.
What's your number three? Two?
No,
where
my
are
number
you?
Two.
Oh,
is,
there you go.
Right. My number two is only on my list because, unlike Dave, I can actually say I saw it in a cinema at the time because it was a friend's cinema and it was in the house. But it's still a cinema. And also, it came out way before I could have seen it at the cinema anyway. Okay. Is Jewel.
To be fair, Jewel actually was released cinematically internationally.
Exactly. Right. It wasn't originally made as a TV movie.
Yeah.
I know it wasn't originally made that, but god damn, man, that movie made an impression on me as a kid because it was like, it was the first time in my mind I can connect the concept that I sat down and went, wow, this film feels different to everything else I've seen. Like, it felt like it was low budget, and it was the first time I felt low budget. Work was that film. Like, I'd always see the TV movies.
It's $10,000 or something.
No, $400,000. Everything,
all right,
which was probably second run.
Right.
But for me, it's just the fact that when I first watched Jewel, I was sitting there going, this doesn't have all of the presence of all these, you know, things. It felt like a TV movie. But it's just so goddamn good.
Yeah.
You don't get that happening.
Well, this is why they released it theatrically overseas. In fact, it's so obviously not meant for a theater because theaters are framed differently to television. Mm. This is the days before widescreen TV.
Yeah.
And if you see it in the cinema, apparently you can actually see Spielberg in the back seat of the car on several shots directing Dennis Weaver, which is supposed to be off frame. But because in the cinema, it's different framing. So it was definitely not meant for the theater, but it was the international distributors. Went, this is too good to pass up.
Mm.
So, all right, where are we up to numbers here?
We're up to number one, guys.
Number one's across the board. Okay.
Right.
Number one.
Now, I don't know what to do here. I've pretty much crossed everything off my list that's good. because we've mentioned them all.
So one of the bottom.
I just brought up, there's a couple there. I've written Napoleon Dynamite here. I don't want to put that as my number one because I realized that was $400,000 and it was a bit of a phenomenon as a result of it. I've actually brought up, because we've been talking about Clerks, Chasing Amy is another one I want to quickly mention.
Great
because
film.
It was only $250,000. It blew me out of the water because I wasn't a Smith fan.
One of his best films.
When it came out, and it was absolutely amazing. I've included, controversially, Super Size Me documentary.
Good film.
Morgan Spurlock. It's a good film.
It's a favorite of mine. So.
Now, the reason this is interesting, it cost $65,000. The reason it's controversial is because a lot more money was spent on advertising.
Yeah.
As a result of it, about $1 million was spent on advertising.
Yeah, so we can't control what studios do.
Absolutely.
Though. We can only control with what they shoot it on, you know?
But the impact went far, far beyond how much money it made back. And this is a movie that actually caused McDonald's, one of the largest companies in the world, to change their marketing campaign.
That's a number one spot winning thing. If you ever were looking for one.
There were McDonald's here in Australia, and it seemed to be the Australian McDonald's that reacted far more to it.
And faster.
Mm. They actually had things like, have you seen that movie? They didn't want to mention it.
Yeah.
And have you seen that movie? Well, here are the real facts. You know, you couldn't convince me that McDonald's was selling healthy food.
No.
But suddenly, they changed their menu. There was a healthy choice menu at McDonald's.
They all went for the heart tick. They were everything they could do.
There was this lovely shade of green on the menus all of a sudden, and salads were being served. I don't know about you, but if I think salad, McDonald's is not the first place I go
definitely
to.
Definitely not what I would look up on the menu when I'm there.
Now, it's a stunt movie. Like, he obviously, it's an extreme thing that he got himself
noticed.
Through. But it got him noticed, and he's got a new movie out now. He's doing the same thing again now for the film industry with the greatest movie ever sold.
Yep.
And
he's got his new one coming out that is being co-done with Joss Whedon.
Right.
Which is about the fans at Comic-Con.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think if you're talking about impact and low budget, that's got it all for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's a good choice. Josh, your number two.
My number one, sorry. My number one is Bad Taste.
Yes!
Yay.
Was shot on an award-winning $30,000. That's it.
Nice.
And the movie is just incredible. It's funny. It's humorous. it kind of almost takes the piss out
of us.
I think
more importantly than its budget, though, is the fact that it was shot over like a year.
Yeah.
Year and a half on weekends.
Yeah, because one of the actors had to go away for a while. It was like there was no shooting schedule to this.
Well,
it
one of the actors actually changes as well. Yeah. They actually, because he left and they put somebody else in.
Yeah. But he's like, the Bela Lugosi of New Zealand.
Exactly. But this guy here was really smart about it. He just sat there, and we all know that he's smart because we've seen what he can do since.
Yeah.
But it was just like, it has so much wrong with it, and it is so all over the place. And it goes from like a small, scary kind of Night of the Living Dead-esque kind of carriage and stuff like that into like full-blown like Invaders from Mars style for a while there, and then just ends up with this crescendo of nonsensical mayhem by the end of the film. And yet the whole time you're grinning like an idiot. Like at no point in that film are you like, man, I wish I was doing something else. It's like, he kept it together under the worst circumstances you could possibly throw
and
at someone.
He has a wonderful sense of humor throughout the whole thing,
yep.
which is what keeps it together.
Exactly. Yeah. If it wasn't for the humor, you would give up a long, long time before you do. But yeah, no, it's a great film. I love it. And I think for its budget, you couldn't have done
it. Actually, I'm going to go out on a limb and say for their budgets, his first three films were all really clever, with Meet the Feebles and with Brain Dead.
Brain Dead.
And you just look and go, with these budgets that he's working with, he did amazing stuff.
It's just a shame he's never gone on to do anything.
It's such a shame that he just kind of disappeared.
He's doing these little low-budget indie films now. Yeah.
All right, my number one, speaking of humor, is Dark Star. 1974, John Carpenter's first film. It was a student film. It was expanded out. Total budget when it's finally expanded out and it's finally up and running, $60,000. Launched the career of Dan O'Bannon, launched the career of John Carpenter. This is still, to this day, one of my favorite comedies of all time. I've said it on the show when you brought it up on a list prior. If I'm ever feeling down, this film never fails to make me laugh. If you haven't seen Dark Star, this is a indie gem. Funny stuff. That's it. I've got a couple of honorary mentions. I think you just about used up all yours, didn't you?
I did.
I want to throw out Romper Stomper into the mix as an honorary mention. 1992 Australian film. I don't know the budget, but I do know that it was less than $1 million. I can't find an exact figure. Very good, solid debut from Jeffrey Wright. Open Water, the shark film. $500,000. Shot completely on DV. Real sharks.
That's how you do a shark film.
Yeah. Interesting film. Not perfect. Interesting film. We cannot do a list like this without mentioning the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, of course. Yeah, we can.
$60,000 in the making, $350 million, I think, in final worldwide take. This is a phenomenon.
It is. I'm joking about that. To be honest, that film did for me what so many other films like it did, which is it taps into your primal fear, and camping will never be the same because of that film.
I never thought of the film quite the way, say, I never got super petrified by it or any of these things that a lot of people seem to be really affected by this film.
But it hits you in the back of your mind. I'm sorry, but it does. There's always that thing when you hear a noise out camping.
I think the problem with it is that there's no real payoff to the film. So it's quite tense all the way through and then just kind of ends.
Yeah.
And because there's no payoff, it kind of, you sit there and go, oh, come on.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas things like The Tunnel have payoff, you know? And so I think that was the biggest problem with Blair Witch, was the fact that it had no payoff at the end.
Yeah.
And if it had a payoff, it would have been a much better film. So.
And I think by the time it got to Australia, at least, there was a lot of hype around it, and we kind of knew.
We kind of knew.
And that was the problem.
I have one more as well. This is actually in the slightly high end of the low budgets. It's $1.2 million.
Nice.
But it's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Babies.
What was
that? Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Which was Soderbergh's debut film, which has a powerhouse debut film. It's an amazing film. I actually thought it was made on a lot less, funnily enough. It must have been on cast. Because he had Spader in there.
That's true.
He probably had to pay a little bit on that. But it's a great film. It is low budget, and it was an indie darling. And it really, when you think about it, when you've got that era, that period of time, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Clerks coming out, El Mariachi, it was the golden time of that low-budget filmmaker. They were all within 2 years of each other, you know?
Yeah.
So hopefully we're heading for that now at the moment. Digital has made things so cheap to do. We're seeing a lot more low budget stuff come out. Love or hate Paranormal Activity, it struck a chord.
Oh yeah,
you know, and it definitely struck a chord with people, and it got out there, and that was dirt cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think there was a quote from Francis Ford Coppola many years ago when home video was first coming about, who basically said there is going to come a time in the future when anybody can pick up a video camera and make a film of the same quality of what we're doing at a fraction of the cost. And everybody kind of scoffed at him. It's happening right now. So yeah. He was onto something. All right, we're going to finish up here. We're running way long today.
Like way long.
We're on the 2-hour mark. Let's wrap this puppy up really fast and say if you agree or disagree with anything that we've had to say today. Thank you, Josh. Send your email to feedback@filmactually.com or drop us a voicemail 02-801-1-3167. That's a Sydney number. If you're outside of Sydney, feel free to use our Skype address, which is just geekactually, all one word. Merchandise, join the fan page, follow us on Twitter, do any of those things, you know, any of that social stuff. You just go to geekactually.com. There's a follow us link right there on the front page, and that will take you to wherever you need to go. Remember, this show does go out live. You can come watch us. Join in our chat room. Our chat room has kind of thinned out like crazy. I think we've been going way too long for them.
I think it's just too cold.
You join us at geekactually.com/live, Australian Eastern Standard Time, UTC+10, every Saturday at 12 p.m. approximately is where we start our recording day. Brad and Charlie are back. Catch them over at reboundradio.com. They were the former hosts of Movie Fan House. They are back in line. The new podcast is coming soon, but their site is up now. Catch them there. Richard, where can we find out more about you?
Well, you can find me online at the real. Oh, okay, I can't even say the name of my own website.
Stop. Take two.
You can find me online at therealbits.com or dvdbits.com. Or if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's just dvdbits.
I love the fact that it's just really radio voice. Or you can follow me on Twitter. And Josh, where can we find out more about you?
Well, obviously here. There's lots of stuff here. I also do writing for Cinefools, which you can find over at cinefools.com. And, of course, Raw DLC, which is our gaming website. Go over and check it out. We will be doing shows this week coming, even though the picture does actually say that we may be out for a couple of weeks. Hopefully, we will be doing it from Dave's studio, assuming that we can get everything working.
And as long as, you know, I keep liking you.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen. All right, just two more shout-outs to our friends. WeekendRonan.com is the home of the real junkies. They're a podcast like us, but they like to drink tequila while doing it, so the results are always kind of mixed. But they're really good, cool guys. Love them over there. Boys, we love you. Come and join our show again. And our cartoonist, Josh Spencer, over at attackninja.blogspot.com, who's the man who is responsible for our wonderful caricatures on our artwork. Today, we are finishing the show. Oh, I almost forgot her. She's going to hate me if I forget her. Rachel over at the Funky Film Show. I love you, darling. And I wasn't forgetting you on purpose, since we're running late. Yes. Radio Fremantle, 107.9 FM. Every Thursday, you can find her show. Or if you can't get it on the night, you can go to radiofremantle.com. There you go. There's your plug. All right. Nicholas, we don't have time for you right now. All right, so
he has a son. He does stuff.
Go to youtube.com/Nicky McVeigh. There you go. You can find his animations. All right. Next. He gets mad at me if I don't plug him.
Next.
All right. Now, we are finishing the show today with a track from The Tunnel. This is a group called Motion Fused, and they used a track from their album called Reflection of Madness as the opening title track to the film. So we're going to finish up with that because I couldn't find the soundtrack to The Hangover. So there you go. End of story. With all that being said, you guys got any more? No?
I'm good.
Good. In that case, go see more movies. You don't see enough movies, and all of life's questions are answered in the movies, and we will see you all next week. Bye now, everybody.